Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You better cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Katie Wright, special assistant to the Half in Ten campaign for the folks over at the Center for American Progress. You know, as we've seen poverty rates go through the roof, every state affected by it, this program's looking for the next 10 years to cut the poverty rate in half. Maybe looking at ways that we can get more workers, more wages, more people back to work. Maybe use the tax code to help level the playing field, maybe just a little bit. So it'll be interesting to talk to Katie about that. Also in the second hour, Ted Kirsch, president of AFT Pennsylvania, going to be here talking about the voucher scheme that's being rammed down our throat. And, you know, last night we talked about that classroom in Detroit cited by the fire department for overcrowding. In a classroom, 55 kids in a kindergarten class. I mean, you know, I remember, and I go back to this, when my daughter first went to kindergarten, they told me there could be 28 kids in the class. I almost did a backflip because most rational studies say 17 to 21, 22 at the most. 28 I thought was high. 55, I would be going ballistic. But here again, this is a poverty-ridden area, and another one of those areas where, oh boy, we can get those privateers in. We can get the profiteers to come in, take over with their little charter schools. It'll be a conservative paradise, which is what they're trying to do to Michigan. But we'll talk to Ted Kirsch about the law here and how we can stop it. Also, Kelly Wolcott, activist, New York City teacher, going to be here talking about the event that happened the other night where they took over the education meeting and said, look, you know, we finally want to be heard and we want education to work for all kids instead of this charade. So it'll be interesting to talk to her and about that. And also in the third hour, David Bacon going to be here. He's in Oakland. The other night we talked with Josh Holland about the war zone situation going on, people being tear gassed, people being shot with rubber bullets and bean bags. And I know everybody has seen the video of the Marine who was shot with something. They're saying it could have been a tear gas canister, could have been a rubber bullet, could have been a bean bag projectile, could have been something, but put him down. He was in critical condition. I guess now he's stable. This is a Marine who went to Iraq twice. And he almost gets killed on the street of his own country. But what really, really, really angered me, and I think most people, is when people rushed to his aid. And they crowded around. One of the cops threw a flash grenade into the crowd. That person should be found. And I'm hoping that the mayor of that city, who now evidently a big supporter of the Occupy movement, big supporter of all the people there, claims her police didn't follow protocol, yet at the end of the day, she's the one responsible. So I got to be honest. You know, I look at Linda Thompson. She's got to be feeling pretty good today. She's only the mayor of a city that's going broke. At least her police force didn't shoot a Marine in the face with a tear gas canister or a rubber bullet. But this woman now all on board, very happy, embracing the occupiers. And you got to be honest, you got to love what these kids did. They came right back. And more of them. And this is what needs to happen every time one of these plutocrats decides that, oh, we're going to put the heavy hand down. We're going to put the hammer down and we're going to stick it to these. More people have to come out in the streets. So they're only doing themselves harm by doing this stuff because it's getting attention. And this idea that, oh, well, they threw rocks. They threw something first. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. With all of the video out there, with all of the surveillance out there, you're telling me that you can't find one? And the police can't. Not one. And that's to the credit of the people who were on the street, and good for them. I got an email just before the show started from Bill. He pointed out a column from a syndicated columnist, and he wanted me to, you know, focus on K Street because, you know, you look at the reality is, while Wall Street is a big, big part of the problem, K Street's right there as well. And there's some occupations going on down there, you know, all across the country. But we need to be looking at the money. We need to be looking at all of the political power in this. And K Street has a lot to do with it. And I think K Street and Wall Street walk hand in hand. They feed at the same trough. And they feed the same pigs. So thanks for the email, Bill. You're spot on, and I'm right there with you. So today, big news today. I don't know if you saw the big news. But I guess, finally, there's been some bipartisanship, maybe something to work on the jobs, something. Evidently, Republicans have agreed to a single portion of the president's jobs plan. So there, if I had my hallelujah clip, I would play that, but I don't. So a single piece of the legislation that Obama put forth, or one of the two pieces, and passed wildly, 405-16, bipartisanship at its best. And I like what the Washington Post said. The withholding provision, which is what this was, passed as part of a larger tax bill under the Bush administration with strong Republican support, but delayed for various reasons to 2013, would repeal the requirement that federal, state, local agencies withhold 3% of certain payments to companies doing business with the government. This requirement was originally adopted as a tax compliance measure, and the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, says that by repealing it, it's going to reduce federal revenues by $11 billion over the next 10 years. So what they've done with their grand agreement is they've actually dug us a little deeper into the hole. Eric Cantor came out and said, boy, this is bipartisanship. It's a common sense solution to support the small businessmen and women of our economy so that they can begin to support and begin to regenerate our ailing economy. Yes, by giving away $11 billion over the next 10 years. Now, understand, it's being repealed by the House. We don't know what the Senate's going to do yet. They're still on vacation. But it's never gone into effect, and it would have only affected really a very small number of people. But, you know, I guess it's still party time. It's still happy days. They've agreed on something. If you want to start with the happy time in this, there has been some agreement. But if you look at this, who'd we help? Well, what we've done is those unscrupulous contractors who aren't going to pay their taxes. There's no way now to hold them accountable. See, the whole reason for the bill, and understand, this is a Bush-era bill. This was something that the Republicans also wanted at one point in the past, because we need to hold people accountable. So when you do work for the state, you do work for the local government, for the federal government, when you're doing government work, they would hold back 3%. And say, as soon as you pay your taxes, we'll release the 3%. And if you don't pay your taxes, we've got the 3%. Well, Republicans didn't want that, and obviously Democrats too. So what we're seeing is bipartisanship. Going to cost you and me $11 billion over the next 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And you look at all of the other things that Republicans have done since they've taken power, and it's, what, been 296 days, and they still haven't really enacted that jobs bill that they so touted back in November of 2010? Scott Lilly, over at the Center for American Progress, he just issued a new report and said that by this cut, gut, and punish agenda that the Republicans have pursued, it has cost 370,000 jobs. There are 250 cuts that they made, and these programs right down the line have cost 370,000 jobs. And, you know, what's interesting to me, the more you look at this, the more you have to go, what was the plan from the beginning? They talked about cuts, and we talked about this before the November election. They were talking about cuts, and somehow those cuts were going to create jobs. Well, those cuts have cost us 370,000 jobs. The experiment has failed. In fact, more people have fallen into poverty. More people have fallen onto the unemployment rolls. And here in Pennsylvania, of the 15,800 jobs lost in September, 8,200 of them were state jobs. So now those 8,200 workers that used to do work for the state, that work's not being done, are now collecting unemployment. They're now getting money and not paying taxes on it. And this just boggles the mind, because the work is still not being done. And what I'm worried about, you look at the 14,000 teachers that we laid off this year, 14,000 teachers and support staff. And you compare that to the 55 kids in the kindergarten class. And I didn't even tell you about the 72 kids in the science class that they cited as well. Is that our future? Is that where we're heading? Are we heading for an education system that's going to crumble around us, where only those who can afford to pay for education, K through 12 education, can go and do it? Are we going back to the good old days of the 90s? The good old 1890s? And I look at this jobs plan. This jobs plan could have put 1.9 million people back to work. And there's a lot in that plan I don't like. But the infrastructure stuff, smart stuff. Investing in our future, smart stuff. Investing in the health of our nation, smart stuff. Cut, gut, and punish, not smart at all. In fact, today we're going to talk about a whole bunch of that stuff. Got some interesting quotes from the billionaire class who, you know what, they want to be taxed. They're saying, please, tax us. We want to make sure that we have an infrastructure to profit off of. We want to make sure that our kids don't have to pick up the slack when they get older. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to talk with Katie Wright, special assistant to the Half in 10 campaign for the folks over at the Center for American Progress. Quick break, back right after this.
Come to talk.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. America encouraged masses of Arab Spring protesters to occupy plazas and squares in Middle Eastern cities, decrying the use of force against them. But apparently it's a different story for American Spring Occupy protesters in the belly of the American Empire. Scores of arrests, tear gas attacks, and other heavy-handed police rousting of the Occupy protest movement happened in Oakland, California, Chicago, and in Atlanta this week. Occupy Oakland's website described what police did to protesters Tuesday. They said that over 500 police in riot gear from cities all over Central California brutally attacked the Occupy Oakland encampment at 14th and Broadway. The police attacked the peaceful protest with flash grenades, tear gas, and rubber bullets after moving in with armored vehicles, according to Occupy Oakland. Iraq War veteran Scott Olson was hospitalized in critical condition with a fractured skull and brain swelling after being hit by a police projectile. Olson is in critical condition in Highland Hospital in Oakland. Apparently, the media was not allowed in to document this repression. Occupy Oakland says over 70 people were arrested and the camp gear was destroyed and or stolen by the riot police. The police in Oakland claimed they fired tear gas on protesters after some in the crowd threw paint and other objects at officers. Hundreds of Occupy protesters insisting on their constitutional right to peacefully assemble refused police orders to leave. Police responded by attacking the protest. So far, there have been no police raids and no gas attacks on Wall Street fat cats to hold any of them accountable for destroying the economy. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's a tremendous dishonor to America when the voices of the powerless are suppressed by the powerful 1%. AFL-CIO spokesperson Allison Omens says that the Labor Federation wants to see elected officials nationwide respect the rights of Occupy protesters to assemble without being arrested and disrupted by police.
The Occupy protesters are peaceful protesters that we've seen for weeks now all over the country, and we're concerned by the mass arrests that we've seen happening in the last couple of days. We urge all elected leaders across the country to enable peaceful protesters to continue to exercise their right to have a voice and to let it be heard.
The UAW says workers at Chrysler have voted to ratify the tentative contract agreement. Skilled trades members had voted against the pact, but the overall vote was for ratification. American Dream protesters looking for answers from politicians who continue to vote no on jobs creation are demanding that U.S. senators meet with them to explain the votes against jobs. About a dozen protesters are showing up every day at Senator Pat Toomey's office in Pennsylvania, vowing to keep it up until he agrees to meet with them or at least speak with them by phone about his jobs votes. Earlier this month, 19 protesters were arrested at Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson's Milwaukee office as they demanded to meet with him on the jobs issue. This newscast made possible in part by OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know,
together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So the Spectrum Group, they've released a poll showing 68% of millionaires, those folks with investable assets of $1 million or more. 68% of them say, yep, raise our taxes. And raise the taxes on people who make $1 million a year or more. Fully 61% of those folks with net worths of $5 million or more say that the taxes should be raised on top earners as well. In fact, Spectrum's George Wolper, he told the Wall Street Journal recently, what this tells us is that there's a number of wealthy folks who said, gee, we need to increase taxes to stimulate the economy. No one likes to be taxed more, but the reality is maybe it has to be done. Gee, do you think? We've got roads and bridges. We've got bridges that are crumbling before our very eyes. It might be a good idea. Anyway, I've asked Katie Wright, Special Assistant to the Half in 10 campaign at the Center for American Progress, to come talk to us a little bit about poverty and what's going on here in the country, how we got here, and how we get out. Katie, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks, Chris, for having me.
You know, I look at this fact that 68% of millionaires are saying, hey, tax me a little bit more and invest in the future of this country, and I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. The Half in 10 campaign, which is the national movement to cut poverty in half over the next 10 years, we just released a report that shows this is possible. We can cut poverty, and we have the tools to do it. The report that we have looks not just at the poverty rate, but a number of other metrics to show kind of where we are now and what we need to do to move the indicators in the right direction.
So, you know, we've seen a lot of reports, but, you know, just for folks, you know, where are we right now? I mean, what is the poverty rate at this point in time?
Right. So the poverty rate right now is actually at 15.1%. We have 42.6 million Americans living in poverty today. That's about one in six. The baseline is pretty dismal. In Pennsylvania, it's a little bit better, but it's still You know, that's still kind of where we are. But what the report really shows is that we have the tools that we need to change that, and we can do it, and we just need to build the political will to get that done.
Yeah, you know, you look at this, and that number is huge, but where does that put us in context with historical numbers? I mean, you know, since the late 60s, you know, we were fighting poverty, trying to make sure that we had a more equal society, and I think we've taken a U-turn at this point.
Absolutely. As I said, we're at a record high with 42.6. That number came out just a month ago. It's pretty dismal. But, you know, we've had high poverty in the past, and we've been able to reduce it. Between 1959 and 1973, we were able to cut it by half. We also cut it by 25% between 1993 and 2000. So these time periods covered kind of, you know, times of deep economic hardship. But out of that hardship came, you know, the movements and the policy change that built the middle class and ushered in times of shared prosperity. That's what we need to do again.
Absolutely. Well, how do we do that? I mean, the numbers are what they are. The economy's in the tank. People are struggling to make ends meet. Even people who are working, you know, 40, 50, 60 hours a week, they're struggling to stay out of poverty.
Absolutely.
What do we do?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. One big way we can do that is to create good jobs. So not just any job, but good quality jobs. One of the ways we can do that is to increase union participation. Unionization increases wages. It makes folks more likely to have a job that has health benefits, retirement benefits. We can raise and index the minimum wage to inflation. Right now we're at about $7.25 an hour. That's lower than the level we were at in the 60s, which is about $8.41 an hour. And we can work on job quality issues, you know, having benefits like paid sick leave available so that, you know, families don't need to make the choice between keeping their job or caring for a sick child or taking care of themselves. So jobs is a huge component of that. We can also strengthen families and communities and promote economic security. Family asset building, creating a savings account is a great cushion for families so that they can weather tough economic times. And, you know, a job loss or, you know, medical emergency doesn't force families to stop paying their bills or their mortgage.
Yeah, I'm sure people would love to have a savings account if they could make sure that they could put food on the table first.
Absolutely.
You know, and I listened to the, you know, Snow White and the other seven dwarfs who are running around trying to become president. And all I keep hearing from them is, let's cut the minimum wage. In fact, we could do away with the minimum wage. You listen to Herman Cain and his 999 or 909 or whatever the heck it is. He wants to have opportunity zones. And those opportunity zones are doing absolutely everything opposite of what you just said. Gutting minimum wage laws, gutting worker protection laws, gutting any law, and just having, you know, basically a corporate Wild West.
Exactly. And one other big thing that's a huge concern is deficit reduction and reckless deficit reduction. Now is definitely not the time to be disinvesting from programs like Head Start or job training or, you know, Women, Infants, and Children program, which helps expectant low-income moms. These are programs that help kids in a healthy economy. I think a great point to reiterate with these folks who are running is that poverty is not just a moral concern. It's also an economic concern. Child poverty alone costs the economy $500 billion a year in lost productivity, increased criminal justice expenditures. Yep. We can't afford that right now.
Absolutely not.
So we need to be investing, not disinvesting.
And, you know, I was looking at your site a little bit before the show, and one of the things, and Pennsylvania does, I guess, fairly well on most of the indicators on there. We're on most things, we're okay. But the one thing that jumped out at me was this high number of 16 to 19-year-olds who are either not in school and not in the workforce. I think you called them disconnected youth. And, you know, I thought, man, we're losing that generation. And in that category,
absolutely,
we are dead last. Dead last.
That's right. It's about one in six youth in Pennsylvania who are disconnected, at, you know, not in school or not in the workforce. And the national average is about, you know, less than one in ten. So that's a really kind of stark statistic. But, you know, that just brings it back to the things that we need to do is to create good jobs so that when these kids do get back into the workforce, they have a good quality job that can sustain their families. We need to protect the programs that help people living in poverty. A lot of these kids often come from impoverished homes. All the issues are so interconnected, and that's why this is just not the time to be pursuing anything other than a jobs agenda.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Katie Wright, Special Assistant to the Half in 10 campaign over at the Center for American Progress. Katie, you look at this, and I have a lot of Tea Party friends who all they care about is cutting the debt. Cut the debt. It's the deficit. It's the debt. That's all we care about. Could care about nothing else. And the Republicans slash gut and cut and punish agenda is right down where they want to go because it hasn't affected them personally yet. But this disinvestment, like we've done to our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our airports, our waterways, all of that stuff, it is crumbling right before our very eyes. If we don't pick up the ball at some point, we're going to end up like some third world country eventually.
Absolutely. Reducing poverty is critical to American competitiveness. The middle class is the engine of our economy, and if we aren't able to build that middle class, make sure that people who are low income have the ladders out of poverty that they need to reach that point and stay there, we really will fall, and we will see that happen if we continue down this path, which is really why now is the time. We're at record highs. Now is the time to reduce poverty, and we have a plan to do that.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, we've got a recalcitrant Republican Party. They are hell-bent on allowing nothing to happen.
Right. So it is a tough political time. But you know what does get through these policymakers is hearing from their constituents, hearing from a grassroots movement of people who see that income inequality and who have something to say about it. The best thing we can do now is hold their feet to the fire and say, you know what, I'm concerned about the number of disconnected youth in my state. What is this going to mean for America's future? I'm going to take that data from our report and include it in an op-ed or a letter to the editor, or folks should tweet about it. They should call their members. They should make sure that they're hearing, what we've already seen happening in the streets, which is just that this level of income inequality is not acceptable. It's not serving 99% of us.
Yeah, and you bring up the 99%, and you look at all the things going around in the country with all these folks occupying different parts of the country, and you go, this is now the time to be talking about this. And I think they have moved the message farther in a month and a half than people who've been working on this stuff their entire life, because we are talking about income inequality. We are talking about how we can close that gap, and maybe, as Krugman called it, have another great compression where, we live semi-middle-class existences again.
Right, definitely. I think they have brought up some really great points. It's important that we're having a national conversation about this. I think that's great, and I think it's moving things in the right direction. So what we need is that grassroots movement. We need those people to keep sharing their voices, and this report, hopefully, and the data contained in it, will be a resource for folks to kind of know where we stand and then where we need to go with this.
So if people wanted to get involved with the Half in 10 project, halfin10.org, the website, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Katie Wright's name. It'll take you right there. Is this something you're trying to bring people into? Is this a policy agenda? Tell me a little bit, if you would.
For sure. So this report definitely kind of, it lays the groundwork for what we need to do. We're going to put out a report like this every year for the next 10 years to make sure we're holding policymakers accountable, saying here's where we are in 2010. And next year, in 2011, we'll say what changed, what policy changes happened or didn't happen, and how is that taking us closer or farther from the Half in 10 goal. So it's both a set of data, it is a policy agenda, but really it's an accountability piece. It's a tool for advocates working in their own communities, in their own state. We're hoping to resource them with this so that they can take it and run with it. We have 50 state-by-state fact sheets, as you saw on our site, so that you can see all the information for your state and take that in with you when you meet with staff of a member in your district or in your state.
I look at what's going on at these different Occupies, and I think there's such a great opportunity for someone to get in there and organize them, because for too long, at least in this state, for too long the unemployed have been shoved into corners, because here in this state we don't have unemployment offices anymore. You do everything over the phone or on the computer. So people are kind of left into the shadows. The unemployed, the underinsured, the uninsured, people are now coming out, and I think this is an excellent opportunity to mobilize people.
Absolutely. And we want to hear from you. If there are things that resources that you would like, that the movement would like, we will create that. That's the big thing that we do, is provide content for movements. And so we hope that this report will be one of those pieces of content that will really galvanize people and keep that conversation going, and keep it going in a way that has actual facts and things to back it up, because that really gets through. It's hard for some of these folks to respond to the moral arguments about poverty, but when you pull out the economic arguments, you show them this data, they really can't run from it.
Yeah, because I think you have to, with some people, you have to be able to say how this affects them personally. How is it, you know, I have a neighbor who could says he could care less about people losing their homes through foreclosure. And I said, well, what if I was going to lose my home and your property value would come down with me? He started to think a little bit. And I think when you're talking about, you know, any issue, you've got to bring it back on some level to how it affects each individual and us as a society.
For sure. And to that end, Half in 10, we have a story bank at halfin10.org/stories that has personal stories, video and written, from people all across the country talking about these programs that are under fire and how they helped them, you know, achieve the American dream. You know, what was that transformative moment in their lives that helped them get where they are? You could look at Tara, for example, from Pennsylvania, who was able to get on food stamps, and that enabled her to feed her child, and she used to go hungry for an entire weekend just so that he wouldn't. Programs like food stamps, programs like Section 8 housing vouchers, programs like Head Start, they help, they really do help people. And if you're ever in doubt, just go to that website. If you have a story to tell like that, please add it. This site has been really great in sharing the personal side of this entire debate, and it's gotten good traction with members of Congress who have seen this, and they've seen the stories, they've incorporated them into their floor speeches in defense of these programs.
Yeah,
it's really important to not only share the data, but also share your story that's behind those statistics.
Yeah, I think people need to hear those stories, and I tell my story quite often. My, you know, when I was a kid, my mother was on welfare a couple of times in between jobs, and it saved us. And for that, I'm grateful. I'm not one of those people like Paul Ryan who will turn around and say, well, I had it, so screw you, I'm closing the door behind me.
Right, exactly.
It is what it is. And over at the Half in 10 page, you can also sign their pledge. Great opportunity to get involved. Katie Wright, I appreciate the time. I'd love to have you back again as this moves down the road and you guys accumulate more stories. Keep up the great work.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Who's the most befuddled Wall Streeter of all? The richest guy on the street. In assessing the spreading Wall Street protest against the greed of today's financial elite, John Paulson turns out to be as confused as a goat on AstroTurf. Oh, he gets it that the people's anger is directed at hedge fund profiteers like him, but he claims they are simply confused on the virtue of accumulated wealth. While he raked in nearly $5 billion in personal pay last year, the largest single haul in Wall Street history, gaining his bonanza from rigged Wall Street casino games, he asserts that the amassing of wealth itself serves the public good. It's unfair, Paulson scolds, that protesters demonstrated in front of his 28,000-square-foot, $15 million mansion on New York's Upper East Side, targeting him as an exemplar of plutocratic excess. Taxes from billionaires like him, he says, are providing huge benefits to everyone in our city. Besides, he points out that he's not merely a billionaire, he's a job creator, as Republican leaders prefer to call corporate chieftains these days. Paulson brags that his hedge fund, quote, has created over 100 high-paying jobs in New York City since its formation. Wow, 100 jobs in a city of over 8 million people. Thanks, John. Our economy wouldn't be the same without you. When it comes down to it, All that Paulson's clique really wants is a little love, a small show of gratitude for all that the richest 1% is doing for us 99% of Americans by making themselves ever richer. In a plaintive press release, he recently wrote that, quote, instead of vilifying our most successful businesses, we should be supporting them and encouraging them. This is Jim Hightower saying, isn't it sad to hear John cry? But then he does have $15 billion in net worth to dry those tears. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast from our site, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program wherever you go. So I'm looking at the paper today, and a guy named Kirk Stoner, he's the director of planning for Cumberland County. He says, well, you know what? I think we might need to ask, well, for a weight restriction on one of our bridges. The Oars Bridge Road bridge, they want to lower the weight limit. And you look at this and you go, is this, as Stoner says, a preview of coming attractions? Because what they're saying now is by lowering the weight limit on this bridge, the Hampton Township Fire Department, they're not going to be able to use that bridge unless there's a, well, a permit. So now we're looking at bridges that may not be able to support emergency equipment. When are we going to wake up? And, you know, so much is being said, so much is being done around the idea of creating jobs and building stuff. And it just seems like almost a no-brainer that even the billionaires get it. And I look at this guy, his name's Barton Biggs. He's a founder and managing partner of the New York-based hedge fund Traxys Partners. He's a big rich guy. He controls multiple billion-dollar investments. This guy is saying, look, austerity is not something we should be doing. We should stimulate and stabilize the economy first, which is what I think most rational people have been saying. Get the economy going. Once the economy starts going, we get back to normal employment levels. People are paying back into the coffers. You got less people in unemployment, less people on the poverty programs, the safety nets not straining so much. Then you start to pull back. Then you start looking at where we can cut. Then you start looking at how we start paying down the debt, like we did in the 90s. Understand, you know, you deficit spend to get things moving. And then when things are back to normal, you pay your bill off. You know, it's like, I go back to my economics professor who said, you know, when you lose your job, you take your credit card, you do a little deficit spending, you buy yourself a new suit, maybe you get a resume done, you buy some paper, some stamps. Smart deficit spending. Now, you don't go on vacation to Hawaii because, hey, I got a couple of days off, but you do smart things like building roads and bridges, same thing. Buy maybe a computer to, you know, to bone up, maybe take a class, something. And then once you get the job, you begin to pay that back. Smart deficit spending. And that's where I think infrastructural improvements, smart. I mean, our airports, for a while, we've seen planes running into each other all the time. Broadband access, I don't know about you, but I can't, my internet at home isn't the greatest, and I've got the best I can possibly get because that's all that's available where we're at. You know, if this nation is going to be internet-based in the coming years, shouldn't we have something that closely resembles 21st century connection? I mean, at one point, we were number one in the world. And then during the Bush years, we fell down to 10th. And as Bush said, that's just 10 spots too low. I guess he starts at zero in his counting. Now we're 15th and falling. So it seems to me this guy, you know, Barton Biggs is saying, look, you need to invest in infrastructure. That's what's going to give you the best bang for your buck. That's what's going to get people back to work. That's what's going to get the economy moving. That's what we should be doing. Important stimulus to get the economy growing again. And get rid of the Bush-era tax cuts, get rid of all that Bush stuff, and move forward. Now, he said we should be raising the retirement age to 70 and increase taxes on the top 1%. And he also suggested cutting military spending down to 2.5% of GDP, which I can't imagine the righties being anywhere near interested in doing that. And if you look at this plan that the Democrats came out with, they had some cuts, but they wanted to increase taxes a little bit. Well, the Republicans, they just said absolutely no, it ain't going to happen. And the super committee, well, not so super right now. And maybe the trigger's the way to go, Jake. Maybe that's the way we have to go with this, because I don't see them, I just don't see them coming to an agreement.
Well, if you look at the makeup of Congress right now, for them to agree to anything is startling. The only thing they will agree with is what they wanted for the last 5 years. They finally agreed to it because basically I think what Obama did, he kind of threw him a piece of candy to get some cooperation. And if that's his idea, I don't think these people are going to cooperate unless they absolutely, absolutely get everything they want.
Well, here again, the Democrats have shown that, it's learned behavior. They have caved again and again and again and again and again. And Republicans know that. That's why this super committee is going to fail. Because the Republicans are dug in. They're saying, we know they're going to cave. We know the Democrats will cave. Because they do it every time. Look at the jobs bill. Obama said, this is my bill. Pass this bill. And then it was, a couple of days? And then he's got another one that breaks it up into smaller pieces? And then another idea, we're just going to do the trade deals, and now we're going to do this one little stupid thing? What about the big stuff? What about getting people back to work? It has been 296 days since they took power? And where's the jobs? Where are the jobs? All I'm seeing, job cuts. In fact, here in Pennsylvania, unemployment rate going the wrong way. The jobs governor, where's he? I mean, he's like Punxsutawney Phil. You see him, he sees his shadow, and he bolts back into the hole. I mean, nothing coming out of there. There's nothing there. And all I do see, when I do see something coming out of here out of Harrisburg, is, let's sell off a state asset. Because, we might get some short-term money for it. And I look at this Scranton Times Leader article, and it's a wonderful, wonderfully rosy analysis. It's titled Pull Cork on State Booze Sales. And it goes through and says, how wonderful it would be. And, we wouldn't lose that much. And, how the analysis is saying if we operated, the liquor stores like a private business, it would be losing money. And I'm going, exactly how you figuring that out? It brings $500 million into the coffers. And you know what nobody is talking about? Nobody at all. What happens if we privatize all these liquor stores? And they get the 3,500 stores that they want. Think about this. There are, 630 liquor stores right now, wine and spirit shops, whatever you want to call them. There are 630 of them right now. They want to jump that up to 3,500. Even if you go with Turd's Eye's 1,500, that's still more than double. But in that report, it says as high as 3,500. How many inspectors do we need to hire? How many people do we need to go and inspect and play undercover cop and do all the things that other states, the cat and mouse game that goes on in every other state to make sure that these upstanding businesses are compliant with the law? And then there's the matter of the tax. Now we got to pay people to make sure that they're paying the tax. So how much are we going to lose in the long run policing what we've privatized, what used to be ours? I got to be honest with you, Jake. I really don't care about the liquor stores one way or another. I don't drink alcohol. It's not going to affect me. But from a societal standpoint, from a business standpoint, none of their arguments hold water. It's a dumb idea. The way it is now is just fine. Leave it the hell alone.
Well, and then you look at Terzai's proposals. If his proposals on the taxation scheme he wants to use, judging from the analysis given, the proposal that he put out a lot of the wines that I would say the average purchaser of wine and spirits in this state buys are gonna, their taxes are gonna be up, go up, and depending on what you buy, considerably. What did we see? An example went up 7 times, and these are the figures that Terzai has given out. We don't even talk about that, but yet if you listen to the Republicans, oh, this is good for the consumer. You're gonna have more choice. The market's gonna work its magic, and you're gonna have lower prices. Not so.
And you look at this, and it's just mind-blowing that we have this asset that's paying money into the state coffers. It's controlled. We're not spending all of this time policing it, and yet they want to create a system of chaos. It's mind-boggling, but it is their worldview. And as Corbett said, he said, I don't care if I get a dime for it, just as long as we get rid of it. You know, just as long as it's no longer government. And there are those people, that's what they believe. It's not a core function of government. We just have to get rid of it for getting rid of its sake. Not that it's going to help the taxpayer, not that it's going to help the state, just for the sake of getting rid of it. That's all it's about.
Well, and what happens, Rick, if they do away with the wine and spirit stores, and even if they go with the 3,500 and they realize, oh, we're woefully short, what's to prevent them at some point saying, hey, we're going to double that number? And then we're really going to have some adverse effects on society. And I think that's very much being minimized.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind, right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseccu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We
saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
So the Borowitz Report has printed a letter from corporate America. In fact, it's a special offer from America's corporations inviting you to share in the American dream. The letter from corporate America says, Dear American corporations have been taking a beating recently. We've been accused of everything from buying elections to subverting the Constitution to being a puppet master of the Supreme Court. All these charges, we say, well, duh, of course. As a wise man once said, corporations are people. Therefore, to be treated like a person in America today, it stands to reason that you must become a corporation. That's why, for a limited time, we're offering every man, woman, and child in this country a chance to incorporate and become a card-carrying member of Corporations of America, American Corporations, or CAC, trademarked, of course. As a newly formed corporation, you'll immediately reap the benefits that such other CAC members as the Koch brothers enjoy, such as exemption from federal, state, and local taxes, freedom to despoil America's air, water, and bird life, exclusive opportunities to sell weapons to Iran. So join us, won't you? Wire the Corporation of American Corporations a payment of $10,000 and start enjoying the rights and privileges of the U.S. Constitution used to grant to ordinary, everyday individuals. Don't pass up this American offer, this amazing offer. We promise you, it's too big to fail. Sincerely, the Corporation of American Corporations. And now, while that's funny, it's really not, because it's kind of true. And if you look at all of the money that has been flowing since our Supreme Court decided that corporations were people, the Citizens United case that has just flooded money into politics, our friends over at the Center for American Progress came up with an interesting new report. Or they've cited an interesting new report by three leading watchdog groups and judicial independence groups. And they're saying, look, this report says the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council of Alabama, and the Illinois Civil Justice League spent 13 times as much money trying to influence state Supreme Court elections than the entire labor movement spent. Just these three groups. And they go through and they look at the money that these big Republican groups have. And some Democratic Party groups as well. Where all this money is just flowing into this. The Michigan Republican Party spent over $4 million. It's absolutely amazing the money that is just flowing into this. And until we get our hands on around the idea of stopping this, and getting money out of politics, we're going to continue down this path. And, you know, the idea that the 13 times the amount of money for judiciary races, and that's not even the one in Wisconsin, which was just obscene. But the right, they've understood for some time. And, again, I go back to the Powell memo from 1971, and you go, he was right. They spent an awful lot of money changing hearts and minds, and they spent an awful lot of money buying the judiciary. And if you remember back, I think it was March, there was a group that did a study. In fact, it was co-authored by a conservative court of appeals judge, who, you know, pretty much laid out what we already knew, that the Roberts Court favors corporate special interest. Knew that all along. And if I remember right, according to the study, the Roberts Court rules in favor of business like at that time it was like 61% of the time. Which had been like a 15-point spike over the 5 years before Roberts became Chief Justice. And they had quoted this guy, Carter Phillips, who I guess frequently represents the Chamber of Commerce in front of the Supreme Court. In fact, this guy has represented more cases, has argued more cases before the Supreme Court than anybody, any other private attorney in the country. And he said, quote, "I know from personal experience that the Chamber's support carries significant weight with the justices." He went on to say, except for the Solicitor General representing the United States, no single entity has more influence on what cases the Supreme Court decides and how it decides them than the National Chamber Litigation Center. And this report by this Court of Appeals Justice concluded that the Roberts Court was more likely to side with the Chamber of Commerce Every single justice, not just the five conservative justices, but all of them, were more likely to side with corporations in the Chamber of Commerce than any justice who held their seat 25 years ago. And it just shows how well the radical right and the big moneyed interests have done at buying their way into our judiciary, at buying their way into our courts and the decision-making process of our nation. And the reason I bring this up, because evidently November 10th is going to be the big day when the Supreme Court decides if they're going to take the health care law. Now, understand, 61% of the cases, this guy is saying, and I've seen a report that said 71% of the business cases. Now, 61 may just be the chamber. 71% I saw of the number of all business cases, siding with business over people. What do you think is going to happen November 10th? They're saying it could be the following Monday, the 14th, but one of these days the Supreme Court's going to decide if they're going to hear the case. Now, I don't see how they can not hear the case because there are too many decisions in the lower courts that differ and cause too much trouble. There's got to be a final decision here in the Supreme Court that I think they have to take it. I don't think there's any option here. But where do you think they're going to go with this? Are they going to be on the side of the chamber, on the side of big business, or are they going to be on the side of the Obama administration? Personally, there's part of me that would like to see it thrown out and start over and go for single payer. But that is never going to happen. We will not see single payer. If anything, we will see a more radical form of what got us into the mess we're in already. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes in November. And keep an eye, mark your calendars, the 10th, at the latest, the 14th, they will make the choice on which of the six cases, I guess there's five, there's six cases, there's five that they're going to choose from. So they may, who knows what's going to happen, and we'll see. But it will be a huge decision when it comes down. And, of course, Michelle Bachmann thinks it's all about her, and the administration is just trying to torpedo her campaign. Michelle, you've already done that. Congratulations. You don't need the Obama administration to help you torpedo your campaign. You did it all on your own. So it'll be interesting, Jake, November 10th or the 14th to make sure that we keep an eye on that.
So what do you think at the end of the day?
I think they're going to rule that everything except the mandate is constitutional. There's part of me that thinks that this is a very pro-business court. But, you know, here's the thing, and this is where the business community has given Obama more money than they've given any Republican candidate. I mean, not the business community, the medical field, the medical industry, the drug companies, the hospitals, the doctors. They've given more money. And I just saw it just a little bit before. They gave him a whole, like twice as much as they gave Romney, like three times as much as they gave Perry. So well, I'm not really sure.
The president gave them 30 more million customers.
Well, 32, yeah.
So that's understandable.
At the end of it, I'm not a huge fan of the law. I haven't been from the beginning. There are some good parts to it. There are a lot of good things. But I think without that mandate, I think without making sure that everybody's in, I think you end up having a system where you end up paying for the sickest among us.
But we're assuming that in a relatively short time we're going to have another opportunity. I'm not sure that's true, right?
I don't think it is either. So this is
so
the starting point?
As poor as it is, and you and I both know it was probably out of A, B, C, and D, it was probably D, D option, very minimal, but it still does help a lot of people, and it starts the process of getting us where we should go. We've still got a long way to go, but I'm not so sure stepping back and saying let's start from scratch at this point in history is the best option.
Again, you know, which is why I will vote for Obama in November, next November, Anthony Kennedy. I think it's going to come down to a 4-4 split, and I think Kennedy's going to be the guy who's going to decide it.
Well, I mean, let's be honest here. There are things where you can evolve from the Obama plan into something close to a single payer, something close to a national health care. If our political situation improves a little bit, now are we going to have total control of Congress and the White House by the Democrats? No, I don't see that. But I do see the possibility of us evolving to the point where we can improve it significantly.
But they had total control, and this is what we got. Going to take a quick break right back after this. We're going to talk to Ted Kirsch. Stick around.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. America encouraged masses of Arab Spring protesters to occupy plazas and squares in Middle Eastern cities, decrying the use of force against them. But apparently it's a different story for American Spring Occupy protesters in the belly of the American Empire. Scores of arrests, tear gas attacks, and other heavy-handed police rousting of the Occupy protest movement happened in Oakland, California, Chicago, and in Atlanta this week. Occupy Oakland's website described what police did to protesters Tuesday. They said that over 500 police and riot gear from cities all over Central California brutally attacked the Occupy Oakland encampment at 14th and Broadway. The police attacked the peaceful protest with flash grenades, tear gas, and rubber bullets after moving in with armored vehicles, according to Occupy Oakland. Iraq War veteran Scott Olson was hospitalized in critical condition with a fractured skull and brain swelling after being hit by a police projectile. Olson is in critical condition in Highland Hospital in Oakland. Apparently, the media was not allowed in to document this repression. Occupy Oakland says over 70 people were arrested and the camp gear was destroyed and/or stolen by the riot police. The police in Oakland claimed they fired tear gas on protesters after some in the crowd threw paint and other objects at officers. Hundreds of Occupy protesters insisting on their constitutional right to peacefully assemble refused police orders to leave. Police responded by attacking the protest. So far, there have been no police raids and no gas attacks on Wall Street fat cats to hold any of them accountable for destroying the economy. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's a tremendous dishonor to America when the voices of the powerless are suppressed by the powerful 1%. AFL-CIO spokesperson Allison Omens says that the Labor Federation wants to see elected officials nationwide respect the rights of Occupy protesters to assemble without being arrested and disrupted by police.
The Occupy protesters are peaceful protesters that we've seen for weeks now all over the country, and we're concerned by the mass arrests that we've seen happening in the last couple of days. We urge all elected leaders across the country to enable peaceful protesters to continue to exercise their right to have a voice and to let it be heard.
The UAW says workers at Chrysler have voted to ratify the tentative contract agreement. Skilled trades members had voted against the pact, but the overall vote was for ratification. American Dream protesters looking for answers from politicians who continue to vote no on jobs creation are demanding that U.S. senators meet with them to explain the votes against jobs. About a dozen protesters are showing up every day at Senator Pat Toomey's office in Pennsylvania, vowing to keep it up until he agrees to meet with them or at least speak with them by phone about his jobs votes. Earlier this month, 19 protesters were arrested at Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson's Milwaukee office as they demanded to meet with him on the jobs issue. This newscast made possible in part by OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, make the rules for bosses you would believe. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Last night we talked with David Hecker, president of AFT Michigan, about a story that just grabbed me by the throat. And I've said this before, when my daughter went to kindergarten, there were 28 kids in her class, and I basically flipped out. I saw the report yesterday that a Detroit public school was cited by the fire department for having 55 kids in a kindergarten class. And it was a safety hazard that the fire department said, you can't do this. But that's what the school district's done, and it's because they're bleeding the schools dry in that area because they have this quote-unquote emergency manager, or as our right-wing friends would say, a czar, who has decided to cut, gut, and punish those kids. And what I'm afraid of is this voucher scheme that's working its way through our legislature. In a couple years, we may be seeing 55 kids in a class. That's why I've asked Ted Kirsch, president of AFT Pennsylvania, their website, pa.aft.org. Ted, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for letting me come on, Rick.
You know, I look at this story and it's, you know, 55 kids in a kindergarten class. I mean, I got a 3- and a 5-year-old that I can barely keep track of. How is a teacher going to keep control of 55 5-year-olds?
It's impossible. You know, with all the arguments and everybody's fighting about what's going on in education, one thing is clear. We do know how to do the job right. And one of the key points is early childhood education. We've got to get these kids when they're young. And we also know that small class size works. It's impossible for a teacher to have 55 kids in a kindergarten class and expect that they're going to be successful and learn when each kid has their own needs. And just unbelievable. Where is everybody today with this stuff going on?
It's amazing. You know, I look at the fact that here in Pennsylvania, I saw, maybe you'll correct me on the number, but I saw 14,000 teachers and support staff laid off this school year. Is that about right?
That's about right, and it's just the beginning. And every time you talk about cuts and layoffs, we're talking about services that are being denied to kids. We're talking about bigger classes. We're talking about losing music. We're talking about taking away art. We're talking about taking away services from kids who have special needs. It's nobody's paying attention to what's happening, and pretty soon, we're not going to have a public school system anymore because the profiteers are going to just take over.
Well, I got to be honest, I think that's the goal, isn't it? I mean, there's a handful of people, the handful of the billionaire class, the same people who were against public education from the beginning, the same people who would say, well, there are some kids you just can't educate, so we're not going to. Let them just work in the coal mine, if you remember those folks.
Yeah, but they're coming, going, but now they're taking a different tack. There are people making money out of this. This is about profit. You know, there's a charter school movement going on in Pennsylvania right now. But look at who's making the big bucks and who's supporting it. They're hedge fund managers.
Yep.
They are making all kinds of money out of what's going on. And nobody's paying attention to it. And they're supporting the candidates. They're saying to candidates, and I shouldn't say candidates, political officials, they're saying to them, come to a meeting and we'll give you a contribution. Listen to us. They're buying off the public school supporters.
I was talking to somebody just recently and they were saying that down in the Philly area, Senator Williams and a couple of other a couple of Democrats have gotten somewhere around $5 million in contributions from the DeVos family and the other billionaires who are pushing this. Does that sound right? $5 million?
If you look at where the money's coming from, it might be even more. It's not just some of those billionaires, but they've created organizations, front organizations, like Children First. They're great with slogans. Children First. Who would be opposed to that? The amount of money this organization has to give to candidates, and there's a published list and people can get a look at it, it's just unbelievable. They're buying off the votes in order to make money. What happened to democracy?
Yeah.
What happened to public education, which is what was the backbone of this nation? Why so many of us, and I include myself, I went through the public schools, my kids went through the public schools, we were able to become because of what the public school opportunity we have, and now they're trying to destroy it.
Yeah. You know, I look at all this money, and, you know, the one person said just Tony Williams and a couple of other Democrats took $5 million. The Republicans are just flushing cash. I see ads for K through 12. I see ads, you know, for what you said, you know, Students First and all of these other euphemistically named groups with all of this cash to promote destroying the public system and privatizing it. And I ask the question, well, if they've got all this cash for that, why can't we get that and fix the handful of schools that are struggling and save the ones that are doing really well?
Because we can. It's just there's no will to do it. Just as an example, The last state budget that was adopted by the present governor administration, $900 million was cut from the budget. And that was across the state. That affected every school system.
Yeah.
In addition, the bill that was passed yesterday in the Senate, and, you know, it's not a foregone conclusion that it'll be passed, but in that bill, they had a whole lot of different issues. The EITC, which was really a tax break for business people, was a tax cut of another $100 million from taxes that should be going into the state funds.
So that means I'm going to have to pick that up.
You're going to pick it up or you're going to lose something out of it.
And, you know, the thing is, when you talk about this voucher scheme, you know, they make it sound like it's the lottery ticket. You just won the lottery. It's the golden ticket. It's this wonderful thing. But in reality, if you can have the golden ticket, but if nobody validates it, if no one's accepting it, what do you have?
Well, what people aren't paying attention to are the details of the bills. For instance, under this voucher system, eventually in the next year or two, the people who benefit the most are people whose children are already in private and parochial schools. There's a problem we have. We have to fix some of the schools. We all agree to that. But you're not fixing it when you give money away, taxpayer money, it's our money, to people who already have their kids in public and private school, parochial school. That's not helping the kids who need it. And when you look at the correlation, the facts are all there, but nobody wants to pay attention. This is about poverty. This is the fact that poor people and poor students aren't getting the same opportunities and the same background. And if we're a democracy, we have to equalize it. We have to help those folks who aren't as fortunate as some of us. And that's not what's happening. It's about trying to take the public school system and making it a big payoff for people who are going to make a profit. And there's case after case after case to support it.
You know, you talk about this vouchers, and in my hometown of Cleveland, they've done it for some time, and it's really failed there, and it's really failed badly. And you know,
it's been tried. Excuse me, Rick, but it's been tried in Cleveland, in Milwaukee, wherever it's been tried, it doesn't work. The charter school movement. There is nothing that says the charter schools are more successful. In fact, we have statistics to show they're not more successful. Some are as successful as public school. And there are a few that are a little better. But when you pick your kids, you can always make yourself look good.
Yeah, when you get to pick and choose,
it's
sure.
It's taking money away from public schools. And when you take money away from public schools, you're taking taxpayer money away and giving it to somebody else.
You know, I go back to when I was a kid, and I think about this from the perspective of when I was a grade school kid back in the 70s in Cleveland. They tried this bizarre busing thing. I'm sure you remember a lot of cities did this. They bus poor people from one side of town in crummy school districts to the other side of town in crummy school districts and just shuffle kids around. It didn't really help education much. But I think about this voucher thing. And, you know, what my mother would have been stuck trying to get me into a school. And I can't imagine there being anything in my neighborhood.
If you got a voucher, let's take a voucher, and now they're saying it depends on what your school district pays for a kid. So the amount of money varies. But the most common figure is, say, $9,000. When a student leaves their school, a public school, and goes to, say, a private school, they get $9,000. When you look at the cost of private schools, and I'm from Philadelphia, and we have a number of private schools, they're charging $18,000, $20,000, $22,000. Yep. A $9,000 voucher is not going to let that kid go to that school. They're going to pick and choose the kids they want who will be successful so that they can say it's working. The vast majority of kids won't be accepted. The voucher is meaningless for those kids.
Right. And I want to reiterate that because I think that's the most important point. We had Senator Mike Fulmer on this program a while back, and I asked him about that. I said, if I got this golden ticket, I got this lottery ticket, this wonderful voucher, this transformative little piece of paper, can I send my daughter or my kids to Abington Friends School in Philadelphia, and will it cover the cost? And he said yes, it would cover every cost. And Abington Friends School, I think it's like $30,000 a year.
Yeah, it's not. That's not inaccurate. If that's what he said, he's inaccurate.
But, you know, that's what people are thinking, that this golden ticket is going to cover everything. And the reality is, as you pointed out, it's not.
It's not. And when we talk about the need for money, and I'll switch a little bit here, we have the Marcellus Shale. There is a source of income that can put in millions and millions of dollars into local communities and local school systems, and they're not even talking about that. They're trying to divert and say, well, we'll tax them a little bit, go, we'll fix a couple roads in those communities. You're talking about, if you look at what's happening in other states, tremendous source of income. Why are we giving away to private companies money that could help the people who live in Pennsylvania? And when we say people, let's be more direct. We're talking about helping kids. That's what we could put that money for.
Yeah. I mean, we could just close that magical box in Delaware. Because there are, I don't know if you know, but there are these magical boxes. They're about 4 inches by 4 inches and about a foot long. And they're able to, take all the profits out of Pennsylvania and move them to Delaware. And it scrubs it nice and clean, and it's all laundered money for the corporations not to have to pay tax here.
And all they need is a mailbox, a post office box number, and that's what you're saying.
Yeah, it's a magical box. It scrubs profit.
You know, and when we talk about vouchers, what does our state constitution say? If anybody would take a copy and look at it, and I know nobody does that anymore except for lawyers, the first page, no money should be given to support religious schools. It's very clear.
Yep. In fact, we talked on Monday, we talked with Senator Daylon Leach. On Wednesday, we talked with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Both said the exact same thing. It's unconstitutional, but you've got Senator Williams who says, well, we're going to do it anyway and let the courts figure that out.
Yeah, well, in Pennsylvania, we can't always rely on our courts because, as everyone should remember, we're not picking people on merit and the best people. It's an election. People get elected.
And again, it's about who can raise the
billionaires, billionaires who profit by these changes make contributions to judges' campaign. Well, unfortunate, but that's the reality, and so it's a problem.
It is a problem. Last question I've got for you: how do we stop this thing? I mean, it's through the Senate, it's in the House. The hope is that we can, you know, get to our representatives. Hope is we can stop it there. But what do we do?
I think that we have to get the public to be aware of what's really happening, and to contact their state legislators. To be perfectly honest, I think it was a lot closer in the Senate than most people thought it would be. And I am one that would say that. We thought that, you know, this was all going to take care of it, and it was wired. But I think the House, and there's already indications that many representatives do not agree, I think people have to contact their representatives. And I want to point out, this is not a Democratic or a Republican issue.
Now you got a Democrat pushing the agenda.
That's right. This is a people issue. It's about tax dollars and how are we going to use those scarce resources that we have. And what's important is we've got to fund the public schools because that's what the state is obligated to do. Not private schools, not religious schools. We have an obligation to fund the public schools, and you can't take the money from one place, move it to another, and then say we're meeting our constitutional obligation. It's just not fair.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think the bigger conversation that has to be had, and not that it's a state obligation and not that it's right, but that people need to say this is a value to our, not only our state, but our country, that we have an educated next generation who can take care of us. I think that's important. It's an important conversation to be had.
Yeah, and at one point, and I don't know how much more time I have here, but recent polling data of the people of Pennsylvania, which was done by Terry Madonna from
Franklin and Marshall
at this point, that the majority of people in Pennsylvania oppose this. The people are saying it's not right. Well, we've got to have the people tell their representatives that they should not vote for this.
And I hope that happens. I know I have, and I hope others do too. Ted Kirsch, president of AFT Pennsylvania, pa.aft.org, the website if you want more information. Ted, great talking with you. Look forward to having you back real soon.
Thanks for the invite, Rick.
Alrighty.
Take care.
Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
This is why. Why do we fight? Why we lie?
Podcast Updates. Rick Smith.
Who's the most befuddled Wall Streeter of all? The richest guy on the street. In assessing the spreading Wall Street protest against the greed of today's financial elite, John Paulson turns out to be as confused as a goat on AstroTurf. Oh, he gets it that the people's anger is directed at hedge fund profiteers like him, but he claims they are simply confused on the virtue of accumulated wealth. While he raked in nearly $5 billion in personal pay last year, the largest single haul in Wall Street history, gaining his bonanza from rigged Wall Street casino games, he asserts that the amassing of wealth itself serves the public good. It's unfair, Paulson scolds, that protesters demonstrated in front of his 28,000-square-foot, $15 million mansion on New York's Upper East Side, targeting him as an exemplar of plutocratic excess. Taxes from billionaires like him, he says, are providing huge benefits to everyone in our city. Besides, he points out that he's not merely a billionaire, he's a job creator, as Republican leaders prefer to call corporate chieftains these days. Paulson brags that his hedge fund, quote, has created over 100 high-paying jobs in New York City since its formation. Wow, 100 jobs in a city of over 8 million people. Thanks, John. Our economy wouldn't be the same without you. When it comes down to it, all that Paulson's clique really wants is a little love, a small show of gratitude for all that the richest 1% is doing for us 99% of Americans by making themselves ever richer. In a plaintive press release, he recently wrote that, quote, instead of vilifying our most successful businesses, we should be supporting them and encouraging them. This is Jim Hightower saying, isn't it sad to hear John cry? But then he does have $15 billion in net worth to dry those tears. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Boy, you know, that is the truth. In fact, I don't know if you saw the story recently, and we talked about it the other night. They're actually pulling the health care away from their workers again. Labor had fought a bunch of, faith groups, a bunch of community groups, a bunch of consumer advocacy groups, fought to make sure that, Walmart offered their employees some health care. Well, they're now pulling it back. As mediocre as it was, as expensive as it was, they're taking that away. So again, it's one of those things. And just before the show, I was talking about my grandmother who worked at a department store in Cleveland. It was a unionized department store. In fact, most of them were unionized in Cleveland. And all the workers made a reasonable living. They all had health care. They all had dental insurance. They all had pensions. They were doing well. In fact, in 1985, my grandmother was making $8 an hour. $8 an hour. In 1985. And you look at this latest report that just came out. In the last 36 years, the working people of this country have only seen a $1.32 raise, or $1.23 raise over the last 36 years. And I go back to that time with my grandmother. What are they making at Walmart now? What, eight bucks now with no health insurance? Very little pension? I can tell you, probably no sick days, no vacation days. They came into the Cleveland area, and they crushed all of those good family-sustaining jobs because they were paying, at the time, minimum wage, which at the time was $3.35 an hour. So you can't compete with that. And it's this race to the bottom. It's what Walmart has done. It's that Walmart mentality. I shouldn't even blame Walmart. What I should be blaming are the MBAs, all of these business schools who churn out these profit seekers. Oh, we can slit somebody's throat and it's a buck for me. That's the mentality of this country. And the whole thing with the wine and spirit shops, same thing. And I got a great email during the break from Mike, who said, Rick, if your knucklehead governor is serious about selling the liquor stores for $2 billion, they're not getting $2 billion, Mike. They might get $1.1 to $1.5 billion. So it's not even $2 billion, but we're going to take your number at $2 billion because I love the idea. He says, I have an idea for you folks. He says, seeing that you have around 12.9 million citizens in your state, the citizens should buy the liquor store from the state for the sum of $153.85 each. Assuming a $500 million per year return on that initial investment, every citizen would receive a check for $38.50, which pays off the initial $153.85 in 4 years. And then you get a check every year after that. But here's my problem with it, Mike. And I love the idea, but I already own it. It's already ours. Why in the hell do I want to buy something that's already mine? But I love the idea. And it's, you know, if it's something that has to be bought, we might as well buy it back from ourselves. Which is why, you know, you look at this and you just kind of scratch your head. What's the point? It's paying money back into the coffers, money that I don't have to pay in taxes. And we don't have to write everybody a check, which would cost a portion of that money every time they write a check. You've got to pay the people for that and people to administer it. The system's fine just the way it is. But I agree. 2 points. Our governor is a knucklehead. And it would make a good idea to buy it back ourselves if it had to be privatized. So I appreciate the email. Thanks so much. And again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And look, the answer to our problems in this country are pretty simple. Jobs. Put people back to work. Let them earn a reasonable, rational living wage. Make sure that they have some health security so that they get sick. They don't go bankrupt. Not a bad idea. Maybe a sick day every now and again so when they are sick, they can, you know, spend a day at home getting better so they don't cough on my food like the guy who was going to serve me the other day coughing all over the place. I don't want your germs. Thank you. Seems rational to me, but you've got a party in this country, and with the help of another party, who want to make sure none of that stuff is possible. And I'm angry as can be at our president for not pushing the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have given people the opportunity to collectively bargain. Now, that doesn't automatically mean you're going to make better wages, but what it's going to do is going to make sure that you get a fair shot at getting a portion of what it is that you create. And that, my friends, that's something important. So we can talk about raising the minimum wage. You know, we can talk about a tax code that would benefit, you know, workers and would benefit the poor. We can talk about shifting that stuff around. At the end of the day, I'm one of those people who say, you know what? Make the job I do pay me a reasonable wage and I can put money in my pocket and support my family. And we'll leave the rest alone. But there are some folks who say, you know, we need to move that minimum wage to where it used to be, which is half the average wage, like it used to be. And then for folks who fall below that, you have an enhanced earned income tax credit, which, again, I like. And understand, for those, I know there's some current conservatives out there going, oh, that earned income tax, that's a highway robbery. That earned income tax came from Milton Friedman, someone you righties love to put up on a pedestal and worshipize and do all that. I just made up me a new word, worshipize. And that's why I really want, there's a part of me that really wants Rick Perry, so I can do my dumb accent. You know, I can worshipize stuff. No, maybe not. But that's the thing, Jake. And at the end of this, jobs are what are going to get us out of this. And until we start creating them, and force people to start using that money that's being hoarded, which you do that through the tax code, we're not going to turn around.
You're absolutely right. And think back of how different this country could be when, at the end of the Bush administration, we sent that money out to save those corporations and those banks. If we would have only put in guidelines which said, hey, we save you, Bank A over here, we save you, guess what? You will, if we save you from going bankrupt. The rules change, and you will, without question, use your money to save people's homes. Use your money so that people can buy homes. And you corporations, if you buy into this money, guess what? We save you. They're not going to be big bonuses. And guess what? You're going to create jobs here, not overseas.
Yeah,
and we didn't take that opportunity.
I would only correct one thing. You said use your money. No, use our money. We've given it to you. Use our money the right way. And that's been the argument that the righties have made. We need to give the banks and the wealth class all of the money because they know what to do with it. You poor working stiff, you'll just spend it. Yeah, that's the goal. People spending money, creating demand.
If you remember, Rick, the chairman of the Fed, I'll never forget this, he said, you know, I think he used the term 3 days, but certainly within a week, he said, within as little as 3 days, we could beat another Great Depression. Now, I think he was he was leveraging his position. I think the Bush administration wanted to put as few restrictions on that money as possible, but they were right. They were right. It did save the economy from going into another Great Depression.
At the end of it, you know, they had to make it short because that's all Bush could read was 2 pages. Quick break right back after this. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
In the end, Wall Street, with Obama, Duncan, Bloomberg, Wolcott, and Goldstein as its agents, they want to turn public education into private, profitable businesses. They hope to impose factory regimes of managerial control over educators' working conditions and our students, our children's learning conditions.
That sounds about right. I mean, it sounds like what they're trying to do here in Pennsylvania. I mean, the reality is you look at that vote that just went through yesterday to give these golden tickets. Now we're going to have these wonderful vouchers and everything will be just wonderful. It'll be like, like the kid with the candy, like Willy Wonka and the chocolate factory. You're going to have that little golden ticket. The question is, who's going to redeem it? What's public education going to look like? Are we going to look like Detroit, where they have 55 kids in a kindergarten class and they got cited by the fire department for overcrowding? Is that what we're talking about? Sari, sad, sad, sad state of affairs. Well, yeah, the other day, the folks on Occupy Wall Street went to one of the Department of Education meetings and they took it over. One of the folks I'm going to talk to, Kelly Walcott, she's an activist and school teacher there in the Brooklyn School for Collaborative Studies area there in Brooklyn. Kelly, thanks for taking time for me. Kelly, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Tell me what happened the other night when you guys showed up at the meeting.
So, yeah, we coordinated an action which was intended to highlight the problems with mayoral control in a lot of the cities across the U.S. have shut out teacher, student, and parent voices in the educational system. So in order to demonstrate to the chancellor, the mayor, and the panel the importance of voice, we came in with the support of Occupy Wall Street to hold a general assembly highlighting the concerns of parents and teachers and students about the changes that have been made in educational policy in the city by using the people's mic, like is used in the Occupy Wall Street Forum, to have the chancellor actually hear what our concerns really are that they have routinely ignored over the past few years since 2003 when the mayor took control and dissolved the elected school board and replaced it with an appointed school board.
Nice. So we have a whole bunch of czars there as well. Seems to be the Republican way. You know. So let me ask you: did the chancellor listen? Did they, or did they bolt?
They pretty much bolted. The chancellor was invited to attend another meeting with real parents, students, and teachers, not just the people that they cherry-pick to support their points of view, and he declined to accept the invitation for our meeting on November 7th on the steps of the Department of Education. And they pretty much cleared the room really fast. We're pretty sure that they were aware that we were coming, and their strategy was one of diversion. So rather than participating and listening, they just moved their meeting to the third floor, which was lowly attended by a handful of parents in the city about Common Core standards, which was a decision that was implemented from the higher-ups with absolutely no input from the stakeholders in education in the city.
Well, why would we want any input from teachers? Why would we want any input from parents or students? Why would we want that? I mean, you know, I'm sure the chancellor, I'm sure he knows what's best, right?
Well, I wouldn't assume a chancellor that is picked by Bloomberg would, in fact, know best. If anyone knows anything about the fiasco of what happened with Kathy Black, who was the appointee before Dennis Walcott, who is the current chancellor, he chose another one of his friends, essentially, coming out of media, coming out of Hearst Publications, with a pretty notorious record, just like Joel Klein had before her. So the problem is that, you know, they seem to think it's sort of like a daddy knows best quite mentality, that they don't need to listen to the people that are affected by their policies, and that if they continue with a top-down approach towards decision-making and a very business model-oriented model towards education, that, you know, that the school systems will benefit from that. And really, what's behind it is a move to dismantle public education, starving it for funds, meanwhile privatizing education and creating charter schools, making them look as though they are the ripe alternative for public education, but they also do not highlight the fact that charters are flawed as well and statistically are not more successful than public schools. So to completely dishonor the voices of the people that are being educated, parents are concerned for their children, and teachers are concerned for their students, is the wrong approach to making sound policy that improves education in this country.
Yeah, so is everybody listening, does this sound familiar? Are you hearing any of the same common themes? Because right here in Pennsylvania, we're going through the exact kind of same thing. They just rammed through a voucher bill through the Senate. It's going to the House now. We're working on dismantling public education in this state as well. And across the country, it seems to be that we can't make steel anymore. We can't seem to, you know, build things. So the profiteers are looking to education to take that over so that they can fill their coffers that way. And students, teachers, parents, well, be damned.
Yeah, that's, I mean, unfortunately, that theme echoes throughout this country. I mean, if you look back to Wisconsin, which I think kind of triggered what's happening in the U.S. right now, They were absolutely steamrolled by Governor Walker, who is pushing similar policies. We've seen it happening in New Jersey with Governor Christie, who is completely unconcerned and has made a lot of the same moves towards schools as they have in New York City, which is to implement austerity measures and to cut budgets. And then when they cut budgets, I mean, you know, with any institution, once they start making cuts, it makes it harder and harder and harder to function, results in larger class size, reduces services for students, makes the teaching situation harder, makes the learning situation harder, and everything else. And so, yeah, unfortunately, it is a very, very familiar theme.
Yeah, they're not discovering.
Quite tragic.
There's no Magellan in the group, be it Kasich, be it Corbett here in Pennsylvania, be it Christie over there in New Jersey, or Scott down in Florida, or Snyder in Michigan, or LePage up in Maine. They're not Magellan. They're not discovering anything. In fact, they're being handed these positions by people like Alec, by the Chamber of Commerce, by these big think tanks funded by billionaires, and they're just marching soldiers doing the work of the investor class, who's going to rape this country down to taking us back to the 90s, well, the 1890s.
1890s, yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned the 1890s, because one of the first moves that Bloomberg made as mayor and taking mayoral control and dismantling the elected board of education, he also renamed the Department of Education from where it was traditionally housed for about 100 years to the Tweed, what he renamed Tweed Courthouse, which was under Boss Tweed, who is quite well known for his level of corruption, which I would say is a rather ballsy move and also very symbolic in his intentions of what he intends to do with his business expertise as the 1%.
Yep.
And using that towards education.
You know what? You mentioned Wisconsin, and we had spent 9 days in Wisconsin during the occupation back in February. And, you know, in talking about education, the one thing that I believe in talking with the people who were in the Capitol when we were sleeping there, the one thing that I think sparked that whole move was the labor education that those kids got when they were in school. Because in Wisconsin, and this is really rare, in Wisconsin, I guess it's every eighth grader has to take some labor history. So you have some labor education. So when these kids heard the governor say, we're going to call out the National Guard, that education that we had given them, you know, sprung into their mind and said, National Guard calling out, no good can come of that. We better do something. And they sprung into action. And I think that's why you're seeing this systematic dismantling of that kind of critical thinking and that kind of education.
Absolutely. I mean, well, when they're talking about core curriculum and educational priorities and things of that nature, one of the things that's very interesting and also unique about Wisconsin was that in Wisconsin, they made sure they advocated for a law to be passed that labor education was included as a requirement in the state curriculum. And I do think that lent a hand.
No, I talked to kids when we were there. I talked to them and they said, you know, I heard that and it was that spark that made my eyes open and go, I got to look at this.
Yeah. Well, but like I said, that's also the work of the unified labor bodies that are there that promoted a law being passed saying that this should be an essential part of education. This is an essential part of creating an informed citizenry. This is an essential part of our history, which is neglected in much of the textbooks.
Yeah, because we don't want anybody to know where we've come from.
Yeah.
But don't want that to happen. Let me ask you. You know, you're a teacher there in the Brooklyn School for Collaborative Studies in Brooklyn, and also part of the Occupy Wall Street crowd. How are you managing that?
well, with not enough sleep, but nonetheless, I am managing it because the way that I see things is that. If we don't enlist in this fight, then we are just going to continue to see a systematic erosion of the rights of our students and just our rights in general as being Americans living in what's supposed to be a democratic society. I think things have gotten to such a point in this country that we cannot avoid getting involved in this fight. To ignore it just means that we're going to continue to see our rights whittled away. And even though it's a tremendous amount of work, I see it as absolutely vital at this point in time.
I agree with you. As an educator, are you happy with the way the message is being brought out? Are you happy with the direction so far? Because I think what's happened across this country has really been remarkable, that we're actually talking in the mainstream about income inequality, talking about how greed and money and politics is perverting our system, and all of the other things that you guys have and people across the country have pushed and pushed into the mainstream.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things that I am most ecstatic about, is that we have changed the dialogue that people are having, and we are shifting it away from a focus on the Tea Party, which somehow has been trained to argue for dismantling government and dismantling services, dismantling paying taxes and all of these things, which protect people that are in the working class. And to me, I never quite understood that. But I do think that what we have accomplished in at least bringing the issues out into the light, dragging them out of the shadows, which is what the 1% would prefer, is to keep, basically they're pillaging in the shadows into the light, is one of the most important things. And we're starting to see dialogue change tremendously, and even in terms of the bill that is being discussed now about student loans, they can only take 10% of someone's actual income to pay back. That is a very different conversation than was being had before. And it's not just happening in this country, but it's also happening globally. It's going to come into the G20 and other places. And I think it's really important that this action took place when and where it did in the United States, for people to think about globally, nationally, and locally, because we are all part of the same struggle right now.
Absolutely. Last question I've got for you, because, some of my right-wing friends think that what's going on down there is just a bunch of dirty hippies having sex and a bunch of anarchists. So how many dirty hippies have you run into, and are there many of these anarchists who just want to destroy the country and tear the country just into little bits and pieces and make it a communist nation? How many of those have you met?
Yeah, that, obviously, the space that we have and the type of action we're doing attracts all types of every persuasion. So we have people there that are, Ron Paul devotees, to people that label themselves as anarchists, but they are the fringe within the group. The group really actually is laborers, people coming from unions. It's teachers, it's families, it's students that are saddled with debts that they can never pay, and people that have real grievances. So to ignore that is a huge, huge dismissal of the real concerns that American people have. So for the right wing to just try to marginalize and dismiss the message that's coming out of the park is a tremendous mistake, because we actually authentically represent the voice of the people that have been disenfranchised in this country and are worth listening to.
Absolutely.
And I think it's really tragic when people diminish our action to, just focusing on the drummers in the park, which are, they're the 1% of our movement and not the 99% of people that are fighting for economic justice and social justice in this country that we have not realized.
Excellent, excellent point. And the reality is people try to minimize what it is they don't understand. Hopefully we can get to them very soon. And I give you credit, you've done a very nice job. I noticed the cadence, the people's mic cadence there. Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. Thank you so much, Kelly. I appreciate
it's infectious.
The time.
No problem.
All right. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP. Trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view. What a wonderful world this would be.
Well, sadly, it seems that's the direction we're heading. And Pastor Terry Jones, he wants to make this a theocracy. Make this a Christian nation. Remember the guy who, he actually did burn the Quran, if I'm not mistaken. First he said he was going to do it, then he kind of backed out, and then he went and did it anyway. Well, anyway, he's running for president. He is going to try and throw his hat into the ring with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So now I'm going to have to come up with another one because the insane pastor is now going to run for president. Now, he doesn't think he's going to get any support, but he needs to get out there and get out the message. He has a real short agenda. Sharp spending cuts, deport all those illegal aliens, and cut corporate taxes. All the things that Jesus would do. And again, you know, if he truly was this great pastor, you know, you would think he would come out and say, well, you know, we're going to feed the poor and we're going to help and we're going to make sure that there's an opportunity to do things to, you know, make sure that people have a chance up. No, 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 we're going to burn the Quran. What a dumb, again, terrestrial radio. Why can't I say the A word? There's nothing wrong with it. It's just a part of the body, the posterior. Because he is a dumb. Anyway, Rick Perry, I guess stepping on his tongue again. And I guess he's going to end up losing the South over this. Because as governor, he fought to keep the Confederate symbols. Big fan of the Confederate flag. Put it on all the state buildings. Loved it. But now that he's running for president, not so much. The fact that the Texas Sons of Confederate Veterans want to put a Confederate flag on Texas license plates to remember the Texans who died fighting the Civil War. Perry said, no, not going to happen. We don't need to be scraping old wounds, he said. But then his spokeswoman came out and, well, you know, we, you know, while the governor believes this is a decision for the DMV board, he personally doesn't support the Confederate plate. Now the Sons of the Confederate Veterans, response, swift, rather than worry about opening old wounds, they ought to heal them and they need to honor the soldiers. So it'll be interesting to see where Perry goes in this. I mean, he's been doing the flip-flopping thing, mostly just flopping. Well, really, really, really flopping. Went from first in the polls down to sixth. This should finish him off because, you know, where he's strong, South Carolina, the southern states, they're not going to be thrilled with this. And the rising star, the Herman Cain train, getting some bad press now. Turns out, Herman, not the most personable guy to work for. A report from the New York Times says that, you know, when you're riding in the car with him, don't speak to him unless you're spoken to. He's done almost nothing to build a ground game. He's showing his amateurish status. And, in fact, the professional people that he had who had left were saying, hey, you need to do something besides promoting your crummy book. This is running for president, not doing a book tour. And as I've been saying about him all along, I don't think he ever thought he stood a snowball's chance of winning. I think he was in it as a business prospect. I can throw myself out as the black conservative who is willing to stand up and fight against the black so-called liberal, which I'm not saying Obama's anything close to a liberal. But, you know, he threw himself out there, got his book, and he's brilliant. You got to give him credit. Wrote his book, had it published, sold it through his own company, back to himself using campaign money. That's brilliant. You're creating your own demand. He gets it. That's a stimulus. It's helping his economy. But you're never going to hear him say that. But they're saying, you know, he's got some serious problems because he hasn't really spent any time in Iowa or New Hampshire. So it will be interesting to see what happens. Now they're saying, hey, you know, we'll be able to do some of that. You know, we're figuring this out as we go. But the reality is, this is a guy who has really run kind of an amateurish campaign. Now he's done a fantastic job of being a self-promoter, of being charismatic, of being a good speaker and doing the, you know, the talk shows and stuff. But as far as building that swell of volunteers, he's going to have some problems. In fact, one of the people who used to work for him said, we couldn't even get our own campaign email address. What kind of a campaign runs that you can't get your own email address? Like if you're working there, Rick at HermanCain.com, so that you have connections with people. And they tell the story about one of the Tea Party guys he wanted to make the financial chairman of Tennessee. Evidently, they went to some party. Maybe there was a mix-up, who knows what. But he bolts and leaves big donors sitting with their hands in their pockets going, where's Hermie? And then he bolts, leaves town, and then puts someone else into that financial chairman spot there in Tennessee. Didn't even bother to tell this big T-twit that he was out of the running. Amazing, amazing stuff. And I love it. I love watching it because I think he's going to flop as well. And here's the thing. So, you know, it turns out that his staff doesn't like him. And according to Rick Santorum, you've got, because Bachman's staff turned on her. Now you've got Cain's staff turning on him. And according to Rick Santorum, aborted babies don't like Herman Cain either. And I'm wondering how he got that poll. Because that's the ad that he's running. He ran a minute and a half video, and it's really, really kind of desperate. And the question I have is, does Tricky Ricky Santorum have a catchy tax plan like Hermie? You know, Hermie's got the 999 plan. And the rest of the investor class, well, you know, they're not going to pay anything. Under the 999, Buffett pays nothing. The rest of the investor class pays nothing. And according to Rick Santorum, 84% of us, the bottom 84%, we get to pick up the bill. Isn't that nice? Aren't you happy that Herman Cain likes us so much that we get to pay the bill? And you got to see this video that Santorum put out. Desperate, insane. But what else would we expect from our friend Tricky Ricky. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with David Bacon about what happened in Oakland the other night, especially the guy who got shot in the Marine. Two tours in Iraq, shot in the head with either a tear gas canister or a rubber bullet. Sad, sad. Back after this.
The list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Your proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. America encouraged masses of Arab Spring protesters to occupy plazas and squares in Middle Eastern cities, decrying the use of force against them. But apparently it's a different story for American Spring Occupy protesters in the belly of the American Empire. Scores of arrests, tear gas attacks, and other heavy-handed police rousting of the Occupy protest movement happened in Oakland, California, Chicago, and in Atlanta this week. Occupy Oakland's website described what police did to protesters Tuesday. They said that over 500 police in riot gear from cities all over Central California brutally attacked the Occupy Oakland encampment at 14th and Broadway. The police attacked the peaceful protest with flash grenades, tear gas, and rubber bullets after moving in with armored vehicles, according to Occupy Oakland. Iraq War veteran Scott Olson was hospitalized in critical condition with a fractured skull and brain swelling after being hit by a police projectile. Olson is in critical condition in Highland Hospital in Oakland. Apparently, the media was not allowed in to document this repression. Occupy Oakland says over 70 people were arrested and the camp gear was destroyed and or stolen by the riot police. The police in Oakland claimed they fired tear gas on protesters after some in the crowd threw paint and other objects at officers. Hundreds of Occupy protesters insisting on their constitutional right to peacefully assemble refused police orders to leave. Police responded by attacking the protest. So far, there have been no police raids and no gas attacks on Wall Street fat cats to hold any of them accountable for destroying the economy. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's a tremendous dishonor to America when the voices of the powerless are suppressed by the powerful 1%. AFL-CIO spokesperson Allison Omens says that the Labor Federation wants to see elected officials nationwide respect the rights of Occupy protesters to assemble without being arrested and disrupted by police.
The Occupy protesters are peaceful protesters that we've seen for weeks now all over the country, and we're concerned by the mass arrests that we've seen happening in the last couple of days. We urge all elected leaders across the country to enable peaceful protesters to continue to exercise their right to have a voice and to let it be heard.
The UAW says workers at Chrysler have voted to ratify the tentative contract agreement. Skilled trades members had voted against the pact, but the overall vote was for ratification. American Dream protesters looking for answers from politicians who continue to vote no on jobs creation are demanding that U.S. senators meet with them to explain the votes against jobs. About a dozen protesters are showing up every day at Senator Pat Toomey's office in Pennsylvania, vowing to keep it up until he agrees to meet with them or at least speak with them by phone about his jobs votes. Earlier this month, 19 protesters were arrested at Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson's Milwaukee office as they demanded to meet with him on the jobs issue. This newscast made possible in part by OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me. We're gonna make
it. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So as we talked with Josh Holland the other night, Oakland turned into a war zone. We wanted to find out what happened in the aftermath of the tear gas canisters exploding, the rubber bullets being shot all over the place, and the chaos that it looked like through the videos that we saw. That's why I've asked David Bacon, the great photojournalist and author, to come talk to us about what's going on out there in Oakland. David, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Rick.
You know, we talked with Josh the other night while the canisters were exploding and people were in chaos. What's happened in the hours since the assault that went on in the streets?
Well, one of the most positive things, I think, Rick, is that last night about 3,000 people reoccupied the, what's now being called Oscar Graham Plaza. The formal name is Frank Ogawa Plaza, but it was renamed by the occupiers Oscar Graham Plaza after a young man who was murdered by BART police a couple of years ago. And about 3,000 people assembled down at the plaza and held a long assembly, a general assembly meeting. The cops were nowhere in sight. And I think that that was a very important step for people in Oakland to have taken, not only because it reestablished the Occupy Oakland encampment, but also because it, I think, discouraged similar moves that were being contemplated in other areas. Even as the people were meeting last night, there were rumors flying that in San Francisco, the interim mayor Ed Lee had decided to order the police to remove the Occupy San Francisco encampment. There was a mobilization by the Labor Council in San Francisco, by unions, by worker centers, to the Occupy San Francisco site. And the fact that the Oakland demonstrators reoccupied the plaza in Oakland, I think, eventually kept that from happening. In other words, was able to discourage San Francisco from moving in the same direction that Oakland had moved in the previous night. I think also in Los Angeles that there were, there were formal warnings from Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa saying that, you know, the time was up for the Occupy LA encampment. You know, with Los Angeles, there's always the danger of police overreaction and police violence. And
right.
I think that what happened in Oakland was also an object lesson for the city in Los Angeles. And so far, the Occupy Los Angeles site is still intact there. So I think, Rick, all over the country, it's becoming a much more of a struggle for the occupiers to maintain the encampment. And there are moves being made in cities and other parts of the country to remove the encampments. But certainly Oakland was by far the most violent and the most overreaching and the most overreactive of all of those efforts.
So the mayor there, you know, the one who I'm assuming ordered this to happen, she comes out afterwards and says now she's one of the 99%?
Yes, I think that that the mayor was, first of all, this was not a spontaneous act or somehow cops going out of control, because the decision to raid the encampment in Oakland was made, according to an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, on the previous Friday. And when you think about it, it would have to have taken a fair amount of planning there, because they had the sheriff's departments of two counties, they had the California Highway Patrol, they had police departments from surrounding cities, all in there, all in a coordinated way, ready to basically do violence on the protesters there. That took some organization. So I don't think that the mayor can let herself off the hook by saying, well, she didn't know, or somehow it got out of control. I think that this was a planned operation that, in which they were very well aware of the fact that they would have many, many, many police down there with the kind of tear gas, with the rubber pellets, with all of the different things that they used essentially in this kind of overreactive riot control manner on Tuesday night. Nevertheless, I think that the outcry in the Bay Area was so great over that that the mayor is basically backtracking in the face of the complete lack of any kind of political support for what she did. You know, our Congress member Barbara Lee, who is a heroic congresswoman who opposed not only the Iraq War, but opposed the Afghanistan War from the very first moment, was one of the first people to say that the mayor had completely overreacted and that there was no rationale, no excuse, for what she had done, that the occupiers had the right to be in the plaza, and that, in fact, that the city of Oakland should be supporting their right and supporting the encampment rather than trying to remove it, much less to do so with the kind of over presence of the police and this kind of police violence that, we saw on Tuesday night.
So now that she's one of the 99%, is she making it easier for the folks there to maintain the encampment, maybe move in some porta potties, some help to make sure that the health and safety concerns that maybe they had at the beginning are taken care of so that these folks can continue the occupation? Anything in that direction, or is this just lip service?
Well, I think that we have yet to see the complete answer to that question, Rick. What I can tell you is that last night there was no police presence there at all. All the 3,000 people in that plaza there were some fences there that had ringed the plaza. The demonstrators, you know, tore the fences down, reoccupied the plaza. There was no effort by the police to stop them. In fact, I hardly saw a police car anywhere in the vicinity during the time that I was there. So I guess you could say that so far it's sort of an absence of what we saw on the previous evening. Whether or not we're going to see the kind of rational approach that you're proposing, and I've heard it from many other people in Oakland and in the East Bay saying that, well, okay, if there are sanitary problems, you know, the city should help to resolve them, you know, that we need more porta potties or we need better cleanliness facilities. If we need food, you know, we have churches, we have other, you know, social service organizations that can come down and can provide food. If the local businesses in the area are complaining, perhaps we could organize some solidarity evenings in which people deliberately go and try and patronize those businesses so that, you know, people don't feel like they're being pitted against occupiers or the occupiers pitted against them. I think there are many other creative kind of solutions that can, on the one hand, resolve some of the problems that might have existed in that encampment, but also can bring people together in that area rather than seeing the occupiers as somehow an occupying or alien force that needs to be removed.
The thing, let me ask you this, the thing that sparked all this, because initially there were rumors that the occupiers were throwing rocks at police. I haven't seen any videos of that. Then there was a report that the occupiers actually tried to tear gas the police, which is what led to this massive authoritarian reaction. Any truth to that?
Well, certainly there's no truth to the occupiers trying to tear gas the police. The occupiers had no tear gas guns, so the only possible way they could have done that was to throw back at the police whatever, you know, projectiles the police were firing at them. And actually what we did see was the police actually injure an Iraqi war veteran who had come down to the encampment to become part of the occupation. He was hit in the head with a projectile in much the same way as Ruben Salazar was back in the big anti-war march in Los Angeles. And he is now in a hospital in an induced coma. So there are very serious consequences to the police use of these projectiles, not just the gas that people were breathing, but the projectile that actually hit one of the occupiers. I don't think there was any conceivable excuse for the police doing this, you know, doing this at all. As far as whether there were people that were throwing rocks or engaged in, you know, they said at one point that there were people who had sprayed graffiti on a building. I mean, you know, you don't need this huge, massive police presence to get rid of graffiti, and certainly, you know, the massive police presence inspires, you know, rock throwing and by, you know, whatever small group of people is interested in provoking that kind of confrontation. You know, the thing about it, Rick, is that the mayor herself, during the days of the protests over Oscar Grant's killing a year and a half ago, we had some demonstrations in Oakland in which people marched downtown, in which the police were out in force, and the mayor, who at that time was a member of the city council, herself marched at the head of the protesters and put herself, along with other public officials, between the protesters and the police in order to head off that kind of confrontation. So I think that it's really inexplicable to me how a mayor who knows how to do this and who has a history of having done this before can sort of turn the police loose on these occupiers in the way that happened before. You know, what we need is a de-escalation and a demilitarization of the response to the occupation rather than, you know, seeing the police and the removal as in some way being some kind of solution to something. It's not a solution to anything, because really what we need is we need the occupation movement to grow. And in a way, that's kind of what the mayor's latest statement has said. I'm on the side of the occupation. We are part of the 99%. We need the movement to grow. Well, if that's the case, then what are you doing calling out the police?
Excellent point.
We need the occupation to grow, not to shrink.
Right. And she should be out there. Last question I've got for you. You know, the guy who was hit in the, shot in the head with the, it's either the projectile or the tear gas canister in critical condition, in induced coma.
It was a tear gas canister.
Because originally I was told it was a rubber bullet.
No, they weren't sure.
The cop who tossed the flash grenade into the crowd that was trying to help him, have they identified him? And if they do, what should they do with him?
I don't honestly know the answer to that question, Rick. I do know that there have been calls for an investigation. The mayor said that she was going to have an internal investigation. Barbara Lee said, our congresswoman said, we also need an independent outside investigation into what actions were taken by the police and which police were responsible for exactly for doing what. And I think that Congresswoman carries a lot of weight in the East Bay, and I look forward to a commission being established in the way that she has suggested of independent people outside the Oakland City government looking into that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. David Bacon, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. And the photos that you've brought us from the occupation there. Is there a website where people can look at them?
Well, there's a Facebook page. So if people look for, if people search for my name, David Bacon, on Facebook, you'll find the photographs from the events last night.
We will make sure we link it to our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you again really soon.
Thank you very much, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Smith Show.
Who's the most befuddled Wall Streeter of all? The richest guy on the street. In assessing the spreading Wall Street protest against the greed of today's financial elite, John Paulson turns out to be as confused as a goat on AstroTurf. Oh, he gets it that the people's anger is directed at hedge fund profiteers like him, but he claims they are simply confused on the virtue of accumulated wealth. While he raked in nearly $5 billion in personal pay last year, the largest single haul in Wall Street history, gaining his bonanza from rigged Wall Street casino games, he asserts that the amassing of wealth itself serves the public good. It's unfair, Paulson scolds, that protesters demonstrated in front of his 28,000-square-foot, $15 million mansion on New York's Upper East Side, targeting him as an exemplar of plutocratic excess. Taxes from billionaires like him, he says, are providing huge benefits to everyone in our city. Besides, he points out that he's not merely a billionaire, he's a job creator, as Republican leaders prefer to call corporate chieftains these days. Paulson brags that his hedge fund, quote, has created over 100 high-paying jobs in New York City since its formation. Wow, 100 jobs in a city of over 8 million people. Thanks, John. Our economy wouldn't be the same without you. When it comes down to it, all that Paulson's clique really wants is a little love, a small show of gratitude for all that the richest 1% is doing for us 99% of Americans by making themselves ever richer. In a plaintive press release, he recently wrote that, quote, instead of vilifying our most successful businesses, we should be supporting them and encouraging them. This is Jim Hightower saying, isn't it sad to hear John cry? But then he does have $15 billion in net worth to dry those tears. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast right there at the website. Or if you've got the Stitcher app on your smartphone, you can take the program with you to go. You know, you remember seeing, and we talked about this not too long ago, videos from the Wisconsin Capitol. There were these people who were in the Capitol, and they were trying to record with their video cameras the hearings that were going on. And the police were going in and dragging these kids out, bouncing their head off the steps as they're dragging them down the stairway. Because evidently it's against the law to videotape what's going on in the galleries. Completely against the law. In fact, the police will drag you out as they did. And, you know, your melon bouncing off the steps like a basketball, which they also did. But now they've pushed through an idea, and you gotta love this. It's very, very Republican, very right wing. Now I guess there's a new policy at the Capitol in Wisconsin where you can carry your concealed weapon, right there in the viewing areas. You can't bring a video camera, but you can bring a gun. And I gotta be honest, I don't know that I would be all that comfortable with it. If I were a state legislator, I don't know that I'd be all that worried about being videotaped, because I do think they record that stuff anyway. I mean, it's not like your privacy is being invaded because you're already being recorded. I think I'd be concerned about having people up in the galleries taking pot shots. And like Mark Miller, the Senate Minority Leader, said, you know what? I don't think there should be weapons in the Capitol. People should be able to enter public buildings and feel safe. He said there's children that come into this building, for Pete's sake. Now, the one Republican, Robin Voss, her name is, she said, well, you know, people can come in my office. They can have a concealed weapon in my office. I don't care. Really? So if, you know, some of these T-twits walking around with guns, you don't mind? It's kind of scary. And she goes, you know, there's no contradiction. And there's no contradiction between the guns and the video cameras. And you got to love this, you know, because it kind of makes sense. She said you can have a gun in the gallery, but you can't shoot it. Oh, okay. Can I have a camera in the gallery and not shoot it? No. Sorry, can't happen. And I often wonder what happens if you're carrying a gun while you're carrying the camera. Will they arrest you for having the gun? Because you're breaking the law while carrying a gun. Wisconsin also passed a law, and you're going to love this too, got to love Wisconsin, where you can buy liquor now at 6 a.m. I'm wondering if you could take the liquor into the Capitol at 6 a.m. You know, with your gun? No? Remember the Tennessee law where you could take your gun into bars, but only if you ain't drinking? So instead of a designated driver, they have a designated gunner. And you remember the guy who proposed the law just recently was arrested for DUI while carrying a concealed weapon? So much for designated driver or gunner. But it's just insane. I mean, what's this got to do with creating any jobs? Nothing.
Does that mean that you can't have one beer?
No, you're not. According to the Tennessee law, you're not supposed to be drinking at all.
And what's the sense of even having it? It makes no sense at all.
Well, you know, some people drink seltzer water. They just feel better with their gun.
Because
where do you need a gun more than in a bar? Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Lawyers for Jose Padilla. And how many people know who Jose is? He was the guy arrested in 2002. There was a dirty bomb plot, evidently, that he was supposed to be part of. He was found guilty of a number of things. I'm not sure if that had anything to do with it. But he was swept up in 2002 and disappeared. Gone. Imprisoned 4 years without a trial. They say that, you know, he was subjected to a wide array of abuses, things that, you know, have really just mushed his mind. And the ACLU wrote in a statement, the defendants in the case seized Jose Padilla from a civilian jail, hid him away in a military brig precisely to keep the courts from interfering with the terrible things they were doing to him. They go on to say that by granting the defendants immunity for their cruel acts, the defendants being Donald Rumsfeld, The district court vindicated their deliberate efforts to circumvent the Constitution during the war on terror conducted during the years of the little shrub. Now, this was my problem with the whole Patriot Act. And, of course, yesterday we know it turned 10. So congratulations. Happy birthday. But one of the things that bothers me was this whole new designation of someone as an enemy combatant. Now, Jake, I could name you an enemy combatant. I can disappear you somewhere. No one will know where. No one will know why. It is the death of something called habeas corpus. Now, you know, I'm no legal scholar, but I got to be honest. I'd like to know why you're arresting me. I would like to be able to petition the court to find out why you're holding me. That basic, just basic law, I think. He was a U.S. citizen. He is a U.S. citizen. He does have rights, but maybe it's because he's not a corporation.
And those are exactly the things that differentiated us from totalitarian governments. And I don't think the average American understands what we gave up in the Patriot Act. Another thing that bothers me, Rick, is this idea that all the government has to do to get a search warrant, forget about the evidence, forget about the reasons, forget about the legitimacy of it. All they got to do is flash national security, and they have it, which in essence means why even have that protection?
Well, what they have to say is that we're investigating terrorists. We're going after terrorists. We're going after bad guys.
National security.
The terrorists. We're going to go get terrorists. So you look at one of the provisions in the Patriot Act, which is one of the things that I really don't like, because I do believe you should have some privacy in your person and your papers. You do have privacy in your home. I still believe that as a core tenet of this nation. And if you want to search my home, you should have to hand me a search warrant so that, you know, I know you're going through my stuff. But there's something in this called a sneak and peek provision. And now some people will say, well, we need to go find a terrorist. We need to make sure we're checking on a terrorist. Well, the ACLU went back through 2010. And they looked at how many of these sneak and peek provision law went into effect. In 2010, there were 3,970 sneak and peeks. This is where government went into people's homes, rifled through their stuffs, and then left, and nobody knew. Do you know how many were terror-related? Less than 1%. In fact, a minuscule number. 76% of the quote-unquote sneak and peeks were drug-related, 24% other. Less than 1% had anything to do with terrorism. And I got to be honest, I have problems with government. There are things I think government should be doing. I'm a big transparency guy, big accountability guy, but I don't want people to have this kind of power to sneak around on me. And I wonder how many of the people who are at these occupations around the country are right now being sneaked and peeked. How many of the people in Oakland there's somebody rifling through there because they're terrorists. You know, they're trying to bring down the nation. Because if you listen to the right-wing talk shows, that's all they talk about. All these occupiers, they just want to bring the nation down. They hate America. And it's ridiculous, but there's a core group of people, T-Twits, who buy that. They buy the fact that these folks who are standing up, doing what is constitutionally guaranteed, petitioning their government for redress of grievances. Look that up. It's actually in the little Constitution thing you love to talk about. They're actually doing that, and it is protected. So I wonder. I gotta wonder how many sneak and peek provision laws are going in, people being looked into. It scares me when you consolidate that kind of power. I want to have a court saying, "Well, show me some evidence." And there's some things in the Patriot Act that I agreed with. You know, streamlining some things so that you can't keep up with the real terrorists. Having the agencies communicate a little bit better, yeah, those are smart things. But when it comes down to the basic principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I'm sorry, I'm not giving up on it. Not at all. So you got to wonder how many of this is going on with the sneak and peek stuff with the occupiers. So I'm reading this story in the Wall Street Journal, and it's talking about Censorship Incorporated, meaning this company in China who, since we've walked away from Iran, this Chinese telecom company, I can't even say the name, H-U-A-W-E-I, you figure it out, They're now the largest mobile phone operator in the country of Iran. And they're making billions of dollars. But here's the thing about it. And it's beautiful because now you're giving all of these young people these cell phones. And you look at all the occupations. I've got one, too. I've got the smartphone. I'm texting. I'm doing the Facebook. I'm checking my email. I'm making calls. It's a beautiful thing. And the kids in Iran have these, too. But they've got Censorship Incorporated are the people who are providing the service. So do you really think the Chinese are going to give them, or even an American, I question whether our government has the ability to track me and to be able to listen into my calls and do all those things on these phones as well. So do you think China Incorporated is not working with the Iranians to quash any type of occupation, to quash any type of uprising? If you remember in 2009 when that girl got shot, do you remember the video? They needed to stop that. They needed to get that kind of stuff off the web. And who better to go to than the Chinese? And that's what they've been masterful at. They've been masterful at making sure that their people don't get to see what's going on in the rest of the world. In fact, you know, we just talked about recently how they're going and filtering what's coming on through the net, filtering what's going on through the news so that they don't know what's going on here. They don't know that the occupations are happening. They don't know what's going on around the world because they don't want them getting an idea. Because that country's ready to implode because of the labor conditions and what's going on there. And if they see the rest of the world rising up against the oppressors, they may get an idea. And once it gets out of hand there, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle, and they know that.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Economically, you know, what is it now, 20, 25 years that they lessened the chain economically, but make no mistake, they're still a totalitarian nation. Absolutely. And I don't believe the power structure in China is ready in any way, shape, or form to loosen the grip.
So, you know, you look at this and you go, was walking away from Iran the right thing to do? I mean, was the embargo the right thing to do? Because now we just handed the entire telecom sector over to the Chinese. So now you've got the Chinese and the Iranians coming together. And the Chinese and the Russians have been coming together for years now. You're seeing, and look, you don't need to be a geopolitical genius to figure this stuff out. The more relationships that you're seeing in other countries with the Chinese, the more trouble I think we're going to have. And we keep building them up by buying all their stuff. Which is why I keep saying, if we're going to do infrastructure improvements, we should be making our own steel. In fact, we should have our own steel mills right now being built as a matter of national security. You want to do something for homeland defense? Build a bunch of steel mills. Because if we ever get into a war with the Chinese and the Russians, because you know they're going to come together, we're going to need to build something. Don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, we jokingly said, you know, if we get in a war with China, what are we going to say? Hey, you know, we need a 6-month timeout.
Can you make us some chips to put in our smart bombs so we can drop on you?
Could we have that technology back that we kind of gave you, and you promised that you wouldn't use that technology in your military?
Yeah, can we have that?
Can we please have it back?
Can we have that magnet company that makes the magnets for the smart bombs? Can we have those magnets back? I don't think so. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts, comments, questions. You can also email me, Rick, @therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
dishwasher or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one,
call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Service. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job.
Like it always is. It's always an inside job. You look at what happened with the collapse of Wall Street, and it was. It was an absolute inside job. And, you know, I've said a number of times, we don't have those fancy bank robbers anymore. No more Bonnie and Clyde. No more Pretty Boy Floyd. None of that. Bank robbers get caught today. And they get caught quickly. And they get dealt with harshly. But if you become a CEO and you back the truck up to the back of the bank and you offload everything, well, that's just a bad business practice. Sorry. But maybe next time. Better luck next time. Criminals. We should be locking a bunch of them up. Anyway, today in labor history, back in 1904, the New York subway first went into operation. It is the first rapid transit system in the United States. More than 100 workers died during the construction of the first 13 miles of the tunnel and track today back in 1904. And, you know, you look at that, that subway still running to this day, still providing transportation to the folks of New York. And, look, we should have been doing that for generations. We should have been figuring out how to connect our cities and our towns with high-speed rail so that we're not addicted to the automobile and oil. But understand, that's why we're addicted to the automobile and oil. The big banksters and the auto execs and the oil companies, they decided that, not you. Also today, this will be labor history for a generation to come, I think, Huey Elbert Stover. That's a great name. Huey Elbert Stover, former lawman, turned security chief for the Upper Big Branch Mine. Well, convicted in federal court today of lying to government agents and ordering one of his men to destroy documents. This is the guy who's going to fall on the sword? And what did he destroy? What documents? I mean, we already, I think, know everything we need to know. If you've seen these memos written by Don Blankenship, who is the CEO of the company, saying, we don't need to do all that security stuff. We don't need to get involved in all that. We run coal. coal pays the bills. So never mind with that security stuff, never mind with monitoring air quality and dust, the amount of dust, the explosive dust that, like when we talk with Dan Kane from the mine workers, is what caused this. Absolutely preventable. 29 people dead, 29 families without loved ones. It was preventable. And this guy, some low-level schmuck, he's their security chief. He was just a security guard. Barney Fife is now going to jail. And the guy who caused the problem, he's still walking around. There's something wrong. There's something seriously wrong with our legal system when that's what happens, Jack.
They say he could go to prison for 25 years. Now, the plus is, Rick, one of the prosecutors, I guess it was a press conference after this guy was convicted, said this is an ongoing investigation. What I'm hoping he's talking about is looking into what Don Blankenship did, because at the end of the day, he pushed an agenda of ignoring federal regulations to make more money. And that's criminal. And 29 men are dead. And if you look at the cause, there were three separate investigations, Rick, and every one of them said the cause was a combination of a spark along with some methane gas and some coal dust. And according to the both reports, they had inadequate ventilation system. They violated OSHA regulations. In addition to that, these detectors, methane gas, they weren't properly maintained. They were supposed to be changed every month. There were documented documented incidents where sometimes they weren't changed for 3 months. What does that mean? That these miners went in there without the ability to detect methane, which is very dangerous. Now, you tell me who's responsible for those deaths. They might have, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there was no different than lining the men up and shooting them because they were killed by criminal neglect.
Yeah, and you know, the Mine Safety Health Administration, they're the ones who oversee this. I think they're partially responsible. And the reality here is this is a culture thing. Had these folks had union rights, had they had the ability to say, you know what, we're not going into that mine. You know, there are people who say, well, we need stronger mine safety and health people. We need stronger inspectors. We need more of them. Yeah, okay, we do. We need all that. At the end of the day, you still need the guy who's looking at the problem going, I'm going to fix this, or I'm not going to put myself in that way. I drove a truck for years, and you know, I'll tell this story until the day I die. I would go out there. I would inspect it. If there was something wrong, you fixed it. I wasn't taking it. It would sit there for all I care because I was empowered to say no. Now, I know people who didn't have the ability to say no. They worked for non-union companies, and the employer said, well, if you don't take it, the next guy will, and by the way, you're fired. He would take it. And now you're not only putting himself in danger, but everybody else. And the same thing in this kind of a scenario. People need to have the ability who are closest to the problem say no. That is it in a nutshell. And until we change the culture, and people start looking at unions again, and not even, it doesn't even matter if you're talking about the ones that are around today. Start your own collective groups on your workplace saying, no more. That simple, but he may go to jail. He's going to go to jail, hopefully for a very long time, but I'm hoping the rest of the criminals go along with him.
Well, I love the conservatives' answer to creating jobs also is always less regulation. Well, in a 15-month period prior to the accident, they were cited 645 times. They were nailed 1.2 million at the end of the day. It was just cheaper to pay the fine and ignore the federal regulations. And 29 men are dead. And who's been brought to justice?
So, Barney Fife. All righty. So what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Well, that was one of the stories, and I covered it pretty good. But here's an interesting little ditty, and I'm sure you're aware of it. They passed a law. And we talked about it a little bit, the camera law. Now, Pileggi, the leader in the Senate, is saying that, you know, this law is going to save lives. And he pulled out this study that, you know, X number of people were killed because of it, and over 100,000 people were injured because of people going through red lights. Well, when you look at the law, you know, it says the fine's $100. 50 of it goes to the community with where the violation occurred. 50 of it goes to other parts of the state. Now, there's a little ditty in there that this press release, and I think it was done, I think it was omitted purposely. Guess who gets part of the take? The companies who put the cameras in. They get their little take on it. Now, my senator, Mike Falmer, we don't always agree with him, Rick, but I got to tell you, he stood up and he said, look, said I'm opposing this. He said this is unwarranted government interference. I agree with him on that. He also said, look, this bill wasn't vetted. He said, I talked to the police in Philly. You know what they said? You know what they told him? That this, the implementation of cameras has actually caused accidents.
Yeah, because people are slamming on the brakes when they see the yellow light. I don't want to get caught. I don't want to get a ticket. And they slam on the brakes and they get rear-ended. This is a dumb idea. It was a dumb idea when they first came up with it. It's a dumb idea. No, but what it is...
It's a matter of money.
It's a cash cow.
Absolutely. Some of these people up there, they saw that, you know, some of these communities and cities are in bad shape. Like Harrisburg, God knows. And that's another thing. Any city over 18,000, which isn't a real big city, can implement this program. And they saw an easy chance to make a lot of money, and they went for it. But I absolutely believe it's unwarranted intrusion by the government.
And I don't want cameras everywhere. Again, this is that liberty thing. And I know. Well, what do you got to be afraid of? What are you worried about? If you're not doing anything, and like I told the last guy who told me that, fine. What do you got in your pockets? Take it out. And then when takes it out, puts it back in, I'll take it out again.
Well, I guess who are you going to testify against? You know what I mean? The whole thing, it stinks of the book 1984. I think a Senator Farmer in this instance is absolutely right. Unwarranted intrusion.
But here's the thing. That's where the libertarian streak in me runs. And what's amazing to me, in Carlisle, when they wanted to put him in there, the people at the veterans groups are, oh, yeah, put him in. Yeah, we want him, sure. And all the people who, oh, yeah, bring those cameras in. Keep us safe. Really? You're going to maybe be safe where the camera's at, but what about underneath or the other side?
And you get a... And I understand...
You get a bad picture.
This is another issue. There's a lot of flexibility in how they set them up. So maybe one day you go through a light in one community, and the next day you go through a light, the same speed, the same situation. A month later, you get a bill in the mail, $100 bill, and you say... Well, I don't remember that. You know, it's just something innately unfair and intrusive about it.
It's a ripoff waiting to happen. But here again, they don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy, so they're going to screw the little guy.
That's about it.
And the insurance company's pushing for this, because every time you run a red light, they go, oh, you ran a red light. There's a couple of points. We get to jack up your rates.
And are you going to spend $50-$75 in gas to travel to Pittsburgh to fight a $100 bill? I don't think so.
I would. I've done it. I fight every ticket I've ever gotten, I've fought.
Well, let's put it this way. If you have to take off work and then spend all that money in gas, most people are going to say, look, it just doesn't make sense. I don't agree with it. I think it stinks. But from an economic standpoint, I can't afford to take off a day. And that's the reality of it, Rick.
That's a ripoff. But again, you know, it is the Republican way. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're going to come back, wrap things up right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standard Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standard Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
Turns out his own people don't seem to like him. I mean, you know, I love the memo that says if you're in a car with Herman, don't look at him and don't talk to him unless he talks to you first. And according to Rick Santorum, aborted babies don't like him either. So there you go. Kind of amazing. The thing about Tricky Ricky is he doesn't have one of those catchy tax plans. He needs a catchy tax plan. Kane, you know, caught the attention of people with his little marketing ploy, really. The 999 thing. I'm not quite sure how Tricky Ricky's going to do it. I'm not sure what the frothy plan would be. But according to him, the Kane plan would raise taxes on 84% of us while making sure the Buffets of the world and the investor class pay virtually nothing. And the folks over at the Think Progress did a nice little comparison of the Kane plan that says Buffett would pay nothing and, you know, the investor class would pay nothing. And they looked at the Perry plan, which was a 20% flat tax with a whole bunch of weird, bizarre things in it. And then a choice. If you don't like this, you can choose to keep the old one, which I think he thought was kind of gimmicky. Hey, you know, I like it the way it is. I like being taxed the way I am. I'll keep that. Or, you know, do both of them and see which one you pay less at, so we can make sure that we underfund education and infrastructure and our military and everything else. But here again, they went through and they looked at, you know, someone like Buffett, and they came out and said, you know, he's going to pay virtually nothing. He'd pay $2.7 million. He'd get this big tax cut. He'd pay an effective tax rate around 6%. Dick Cheney would have paid about 6% under Perry's plan. And also Obama would have paid, virtually nothing. Because he doesn't, anyway, what's he make, $400,000 now? And Ron Paul wants to take that down to $39,000. So I say vote for Ron Paul. That's quite a bargain. Get a president for $39,000. Granted, you get a crazy little, a little troll kind of a character for $39,000, but that's...
Isn't it amazing? I mean, really, if you think about it, the most powerful position in the world... We're giving him $400,000. They're saying, well, that's way too much, but we don't want to tax the very rich. Tell me that makes sense.
We need to make sure that our CEOs on Wall Street make $49 million. You figure that out. Anyway, I know our signal doesn't quite go to Silver Spring, Pennsylvania. Silver Spring Township, my mother-in-law used to live there. Evidently, they're telling the trick-or-treaters that there may be a black bear walking around. So if you're out trick-or-treating and a black bear comes up to you, you know, take precautions. And I kind of thought about, you know, you go to the door and, you know, trick-or-treat, you're standing there, there's a big black bear there, and you go, oh, wow, what a great costume. And then he eats your face off. And then he eats your face off.
They do love candy.
Yeah, and they do love eating people's faces. So there you go. And I like watching the videos. Have you ever seen the videos from, like, Yosemite or one of these big parks where, oh, honey, go over and stand next to the cute bear? And they go run over there and they get the picture. And then the very next picture you see is the bear eating the guy's face off. And it's amazing how gooey face is. I mean, it's kind of elastic.
Those aren't black bears. Those are...
The grizzlies or whatever.
Those are big, big bears.
Yeah. Oh, honey, go get a picture. Go stand next to the bear. Oh, isn't he cute? Well, you know, all righty. Evidently, I was looking around at the news today. Arizona State University professor. Her name is Dr. Erin Carr Jordan. She did a very bad thing. She went to the McDonald's play areas. You know, they have these playgrounds. You've seen them, right? The McDonald's
yes.
playgrounds. They got some tunnels in it, some balls, a whole bunch of stuff. Well, she went in with her lab kit, did a little CSI on the place, and found dangerous bacteria, found the place to be filthy. She got on national news, and there was a whole campaign kind of thing that she started, you know, to get McDonald's to actually clean the play areas. Well, it turns out she's been banned from all McDonald's. Evidently, she has been sent a notice, please do not come back to McDonald's. And I looked at this and I go, well, isn't the smart thing to do from McDonald's point of view to say, we're going to clean everything. Thank you for pointing it out. We will make sure we take corrective steps. And please come be our spokesman to say how clean we did things instead of going, you're banned.
Well, here's the thing, Rick. If she went in there and got a double cheese with a large order of fries, they probably did her a favor.
Okay, that's somewhere, but okay.
From the health standpoint.
Oh, okay.
The fries are delicious, but
all right.
All that salt and fat.
And here's a suggestion: the next time your girlfriend's over, comes home early, and the girl you met on the internet comes over, and your girlfriend catches her. So the next time that happens to you, I know it happens all the time, but the next time that happens, see, at 3 a.m., I know you do the booty call thing on the internet. Trying to get, you know, young lasses.
Is this going somewhere?
It is, yeah. It's going. It's going quickly. This guy in Colorado, he got on the computer 3 a.m., you know, come on over, invited this girl over to the house. She came, which is amazing to me. Then his girlfriend came home early. Doesn't say what kind of brains this guy's got. The house that he shares with his girlfriend, he's going to, that's a whole other argument. So the both of them are there. He calls the police and says that she's the friend from online is a burglar.
Oh.
He was cited for making a false police report, misdemeanor false reporting charges. I'm sure he'll pay a nice fine, maybe do a day or two in jail. And good for him. Deserved it for being dumb. Dumb. See, now you know better than that, don't you?
Absolutely.
When you do your 3 a.m. booty call, you go to a hotel.
I'm just not a pretty face, you know.
And remember we were talking about the woman who was flying to, I believe it was, I think it was Ireland, Dublin, and she had her vibrator in her suitcase, and someone left a note for her that says, get your freak on. Well, it turns out the TSA has found that person, disciplined them appropriately, and they will no longer be able to check people's bags because the TSA has zero tolerance for that type of behavior. So Jill Filipic, the founder of Feministy, she has now been apologized to. I don't know that she's going to take it because I got to be honest, I don't really know that I would be all that happy with people editorializing on the contents of my luggage. Not that I would be taking a vibrator with me, but who knows? You never know. And lastly, well, she did. She had it in her suitcase. What am I going to say? People carry things in their suitcase. You know, I take a toothbrush that vibrates. Someone could leave a message in my suitcase. And lastly, I saw this article on the best bathrooms in the United States, something that you might be interested in. The Field Museum, it's a beautiful bathroom, beautiful place. But there are a number of them. The top 10, the Field Museum in Chicago, has some wonderful decor. It's just high ceilings, black holes in the wall. Black holes. Larry Craig be very happy with the black holes in the wall. Well, he would be.
Well, I guess I have one question. The one you just put in, is this one of the top 10 here over the weekend?
It is number one.
It is?
It is the number one bathroom in the entire country. It's got some wonderful decor. black holes in the wall. You know, so Larry, when he gets his freak on, he can be very, very happy with that. So I'm trying to figure out the clip problem, but it's just not working.
Let me be clear.
There we go.
I am not gay. I never have been gay.
See, I was going to that for the whole bathroom story, and it just screwed it up. I need to get a new clip player or something, or I need to figure out how to use it. Probably it's my fault. Probably. Anyway, great show today. I was really happy with our guests. Ted Kirsch from AFT, Pennsylvania, talking about the voucher thing. And I'm telling you, what we need to do, we really need to be contacting our representatives. We can stop this thing in the House. It didn't pass by much in the Senate, but the House is where we got to stop it. We'll be back tomorrow night. Have a great night. See you then.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy's coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Good memories are forever. Send the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walks up and...